felt raw, cut open, every nerve a bleeding edge of desire. He licked sugar off her lips, and she moaned. Everything about the fact that this was forbidden was wrong, he thought. Nobody belonged together more than he and Emma did. He almost felt as if their connection scorched its way through their parabatai marks, winding them closer, amplifying every sensation. Just his hand tangling in the soft strands of her hair was enough to make his bones feel as if they were turning to liquid, to fire. When she arched up against him, he thought he might actually die. And then she drew away, taking a long, shuddering breath. She was shaking.
Julian, we can't.
He rolled away from her. It felt like ripping off a limb. His hands dug into the blanket, gripping hard enough to hurt. Emma, he said. It was all he could say.
I want to, she said, raising herself up on an elbow.
Her hair was a mess of golden tangles, her expression earnest.
You have to know I want to. But while we're still parabatai, we can't.
It won't make me love you any more or differently, he said, his voice hoarse. I love you, either way. I love you if we never touch.
I know, but it seems like tempting fate.
She reached to stroke his face, his chest.
Your heart's beating so fast.
It always does, he said, when it's you. He kissed her, a kiss that accepted that tonight there would be no more than kisses. Only you. No one but you. It was true. He had never desired anyone before Emma, and never anyone since. There had been times when he was younger that it had puzzled him. He was a teenager. He was supposed to be full of inchoate longings and wantings and yearnings, wasn't he? But he never wanted anyone, never fantasized or dreamed or longed at all. And then there had been that one day on the beach when Emma had been laughing next to him, and she had reached up to undo her barrette, and her hair had spilled down over her fingers and against her back like liquid sunlight. His whole body had reacted. He remembered it even now, the driving pain as if something deadly had struck him. It had made him understand why the Greeks had believed love was an arrow that tore through your body and left a blazing trail of longing behind. In French, falling in love was the coup de foudre, the bolt of lightning, the fire in your veins, the destructive power of 1,000,000,000 volts. Julian hadn't fallen suddenly in love. He always had been in love. He had only just that moment realized it. And after that he longed. Oh, how he longed, and wished for the time he'd thought he was missing something by not longing, because the longing was like 1,000 cruel voices that whispered to him that he was a fool. It was only 6 months after their parabatai ceremony. It had been the biggest mistake he'd ever made, and totally irrevocable. And every time he saw Emma after that, it was like a knife in his chest, but a knife whose pain he welcomed, a blade whose hilt he'd held in his own hand, pressed against his own heart, and nothing, and no one could have taken it away from him. Sleep, he said. He gathered her in his arms, and she curled up against him, closing her eyes. His Emma. His universe. His blade.
You see, Diana said, it's exactly what we thought it was. The silver-black moon shone down on Brosselin Forest as Gia Penhallow stepped out of the blighted circle of ashy trees and burned grass. As she did, the seraph blade in her hand blazed with light as if a switch had been flipped. She stepped back into the circle. The seraph blade went dark.
I sent photos to Kieran, said Diana, looking at the consul's grim face. Kieran said these were the same kind of circles of blight he had seen in the Unseelie Lands. Most of what Kieran had recently seen in the Unseelie Lands had been inside of a cage. Gia shuddered.
It is awful to stand inside this circle, she said. It feels as if the ground is made of ice, and despair is in the very air.
These circles, Diana said,
They are in the places that Helen and Aline said went dark on their map, aren't they? Gia didn't have to look. She nodded. I had not wanted to bring my daughter into this. If she and Helen can be present during the council meeting, they can speak up as candidates for the Institute. Gia said nothing. It is what Helen desperately wants, said Diana. What they both want. The best place to be is not always the safest. No one is content in a prison. Gia cleared her throat. The time it would take to have the council clear the request, portals to Wrangell Island are tightly regulated. The meeting would be over. Leave that to me, Diana said. In fact, the less you know, the better. Diana couldn't believe she had just said the less you know, the better to the consul. Deciding she was unlikely to come up with a better exit line, she turned and strode from the clearing. Drew dreamed of underground tunnels, split by roots like the bulging knuckles of a giant. She dreamed of a room of glittering weapons and a boy with green eyes. She woke to find the dim light of dawn illuminating her mantle, where a gold hunting dagger inscribed with roses pinned a note to the wood. For Drusilla. Thank you for all your help. Jaime. Sometime in the night, Kit woke, the Arazi softly burning on his arm. The infirmary was lit with warm, yellow light, and outside the window he could see the rooftops of London, sturdy and Victorian under the waning moon. And he could hear music. Rolling on his side, he saw that Ty was asleep on the bed next to Kit's, his headphones on, the faint sound of a symphony coming from them. A memory teased the edge of Kit's consciousness. Being very young, sick with the flu, feverish at night, and someone sleeping by the side of his bed. His father? It must have been. Who else could it have been but his father? But certainty eluded him. No, he wouldn't think about it. It had been part of his earlier life. He was someone now who had friends who would sleep by his bed if he was sick. For however long that lasted, he would appreciate it. The high doors of the sanctuary were made of iron and carved with a symbol Christina had known since birth, the four interconnected C's of Clave, Council, Covenant, and Consul. The doors opened soundlessly at a push onto a large room. Her spine tightened as she stepped inside, remembering the sanctuary and the Mexico City Institute. She had played there sometimes as a child, enjoying the vastness of the space, the silence, the smooth, cold tiles. Every institute had a sanctuary. Kieran, she whispered, stepping inside. Kieran, are you there? The London sanctuary dwarfed the Mexico City and Los Angeles ones in size and impressiveness. Like a vast treasure box of marble and stone, every surface seemed to gleam. There were no windows for the protection of vampire guests. Light came from a number of witchlight torches. In the center of the room rose a fountain. In it stood a stone angel. Its eyes were open holes from which rivers of water poured like tears and spilled into the basin below. Words were inscribed around the base. Afante poropora defluit aqua. A pure fountain gives pure water. Silvery tapestries hung from the walls, though their designs had faded with age. Between two large pillars, a circle of tall, straight-backed chairs were tumbled on their sides, as if someone had knocked them down in a rage. Cushions were strewn across the floor. Kieran stepped noiselessly out from behind the fountain. His chin was raised defiantly, his hair the darkest black Christina had ever seen it. Even the glare of the witchlight torches seemed to sink into it and vanish without reflecting off the strands. How did you get the doors open? Christina asked, glancing over her shoulder at the massive iron wedges. When she turned back, Kieran had raised his hands, open-palmed. They were scored all over with dark red marks, as if he had picked up red-hot pokers and held them tightly. Iron burns. Does it please you? Kieran said. He was breathing hard. Here I am, in your Nephilim iron prison.
course it doesn't please me. She frowned at him. She couldn't help the small voice inside that asked her why she'd come. She hadn't been able to stop herself. She'd been thinking of Kieran alone, betrayed and lost. Perhaps it was the bond between them, the one he'd spoken of in her room. But she'd felt his presence and his unhappiness like a whisper at the back of her mind until she'd gone to look for him.
What are you to mock? He demanded.
Kieran, she said, sit down. Let's sit down and talk. He only stared at her, watchful and tense, like an animal in the woods, ready to break away if she moved.
Christina sat down slowly on the scattered cushions. She smoothed her skirt down, tucking her legs under her.
Please, she said, holding out her hand to indicate the cushion across from hers, as if she were inviting him to tea. He lowered himself onto it like a cat settling, fur ruffled with tension.
The answer is, she said, that I don't know. I don't know what I am to Mark, or he to me.
How can that be? Kieran said. We feel what we feel.
He gazed down at his hands. They were fairy hands, long-jointed, scarred with many small nicks.
In the hunt, he said, it was real. We loved each other. We slept by each other's sides, and we breathed each other's breath, and we were never apart. It was always real. It was never false.
He looked at Christina challengingly.
I never thought that. I always knew it was real, she said. I saw the way Mark looked at you.
She looped her hands together to keep them from shaking.
You know Diego?
The very handsome, stupid one, Kieran said. He's not stupid, not that it matters, Christina added hastily.
I loved him when I was younger, and he loved me. There was a time when we were always together, like you and Mark. Later, he betrayed me.
Mark spoke of it. In Faerie, he would have been killed for such disrespect of a lady of your rank. Christina wasn't entirely sure what Kieran thought her rank was.
Well, the result was that I thought that what we'd had was never real. It hurt more to think that than it did to think that he'd simply stopped loving me. For I had stopped loving him that way, too. We'd grown out of what we had. But that is a natural thing and happens often. It is much more painful to believe that your love was always a lie.
What else am I meant to believe? Kieran demanded. When Mark is willing to lie to me for the clave he despises.
He didn't do it for the clave, said Christina. Have you been listening to anything the Blackthorns have been saying? This is for his family. His sister is in exile because she is part fairy. This is to bring her back.
Kieran's expression was opaque. She knew family meant little to him in the abstract. It was hard to blame him for that. But the Blackthorns, in all their concrete realness, their messy and honest and total love for each other, did he see it?
So do you no longer believe your love with the Rosales boy was a lie? He said.
It was not a lie, she said. Diego has his reasons for what he's doing now. And when I look back, it is with pleasure at the happiness we had. The bad things can't matter more than the good things, Kieran.
Mark told me, he said, that when you went into the ferry, you were each made a promise by the Pooka who guards the gate that you would find something you wanted there.
What was it you wanted?
The Pooka told me I would have the chance to bring the cold peace to an end, said Christina. It is why I agreed when it was decided to cooperate with the Queen.
Kieran looked at her, shaking his head. For a moment she thought he considered her foolish, and her heart sank. He reached to touch her face. The glide of his fingers was feather-light, as if she'd been brushed by the calyx of a flower.
When I swore fealty to you in the court of the Queen, he said, it was to annoy and anger Mark. But now, I think I made a wiser decision than I could have imagined.
You know I'll never hold you to that oath, Kieran.
Yes, and that is why I say you are nothing like I thought you'd be, he said. I have lived in this small world of the wild hunt and fairy courts, yet you make me feel the world is bigger and full of possibility.
He dropped his hand. I have never known someone so generous in the heart.
Christina felt as if her face were on fire. "Mark is also all those things," she said. "When Gwyn came to tell us you were in danger in Ferry, Mark went to get you immediately, regardless of the cost."
"That was a kind thing to tell me," he said. "You've always been kind."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because you could always have taken Mark from me, but you didn't."
"No," Christina said.
"It is as you told Adain. You would not want Mark's love if it did not come freely.
Neither would I.
I would not pressure or influence him.
If you think I would, and that it would work if I did, then you don't know me at all, nor Mark. Not as he really is."
Kieran's lips parted. He didn't speak, though, because the sanctuary doors had opened, and Mark had come in. He was all in black and looked exhausted. The red ring around his wrist drew Christina's eye. Involuntarily, she touched her own wrist, the healing skin of the binding wound.
"I followed you here," he said to Christina. "There's still enough of the binding spell left to allow me to do that. I thought you'd be with Kieran."
Kieran said nothing. He looked like a fairy prince in a painting, remote, unassailable, distant.
"My Lord Kieran," Mark said formally, "can we talk?"
They looked like a painting, both of them, kneeling, Christina's dark hair falling to hide her face. Kieran opposite her was a study in contrasts of black and white. Mark stood in the doorway of the sanctuary for a moment, just watching them, his heart feeling as if it were being compressed inside his chest. He really did have a thing for dark hair, he thought. At that moment, he heard Christina say his name and realized he was eavesdropping. Coming into the sanctuary felt like entering a cold, harsh place. It was bound all around with iron. Kieran must have felt it too, though the look on his face gave no sign. It gave no sign he felt anything at all.
"My Lord Kieran," Mark said, "can we talk?"
Christina rose to her feet.
"I should go."
"You need not." Kieran had leaned back to lounge among the spilled cushions. Fairies did not lie with their words, but they lied with their faces and voices, the gestures of their hands. Right now, anyone looking at Kieran would think he felt nothing but boredom and dislike. But he hadn't left. He was still in the Institute. Mark clung to that.
"I must," Christina said. "Mark and I are not meant to be near each other as the binding spell wears off."
Mark moved closer to her, though, as she went to the door. Their hands brushed. Had he thought she was beautiful the moment he met her? He remembered coming awake to the sound of her voice, seeing her sitting on the floor of his room with her knife open. How grateful he had been that she was someone he had never known before the hunt, someone who would have no expectations of him. She looked at him once and was gone. He was alone with Kieran.
"Why are you here?" Kieran demanded. "Why lower yourself to come before someone you hate?"
"I don't hate you. None of this is because I hated you or wanted to hurt you. I was angry with you, of course I was. Can you understand why?"
Kieran didn't meet Mark's eyes.
"This is why Emma dislikes me," he said. "And Julian." Irloth whipped them both. The whipping he gave Emma would have killed a mundane human.
"I remember," said Kieran miserably, "and yet it seems distant."
He swallowed.
"I knew I was losing you. I was afraid. There was more to it as well.
Irloth had hinted you would not be safe in the Shadowhunter's world, that they were planning to lure you back, only to execute you on some trumped-up charge. I was a fool to believe them and know it now."
"Oh," said Mark. The knowledge unfolded in him, realization edged with relief. "You thought you were saving my life."
Kieran nodded. "It makes no difference, though. What I did was wrong."
"You will have to make your own apology to Emma and Julian," said Mark. "But for my sake, Kieran, I have forgiven you. You returned when you did not have to. You helped to save Tavi."
"When I sought refuge here, I was blinded by rage," Kieran said. "All I could think of was that you lied to me.
I thought you'd come to the court to save me because you... His voice cracked. Because you loved me. I cannot bear to think on my own stupidity.
I do love you, Mark said. But it is not an easy or restful sort of love, Kieran.
Not like what you feel for Christina.
No, said Mark.
Not like what I feel for Christina. Kieran's shoulders sagged slightly.
I'm glad you admit it, he said. I could not tolerate a lie now, I think.
When I first loved you, I knew it was loving something that could lie. I told myself it would not matter, but it matters more than I ever thought.
Mark closed the distance between them. He was half certain that Kieran would back away from him, but the other boy didn't move. Mark approached until there were only inches of space between them, until Kieran's eyes had widened, and then Mark knelt, cold marble against his knees.
It was a gesture he had seen before, in the hunt and at revels, one fairy kneeling to another. Not submission, but an apology.
Forgive me. Kieran's eyes were like saucers. It does matter, Mark said. I wish that I could not lie, so that you would believe me. All these days, I have not held back from affection with you because I was angry at you or sickened. I wanted you just as I did in the hunt, but I could not be with you, touch you with all of its shadow by lies. It would not have felt true or honest. It would not have felt as if you were choosing me, because to make a true choice, we must have true knowledge. Mark, Kieran whispered, I do not love you as I love Christina. I love you as I love you, said Mark. He bent his head. I wish that you could see my heart. Then you would understand.
There was a rustling sound. Kieran had sunk to his own knees, level with Mark.
Would you have told me, he said, after the testimony? Yes, I couldn't have stood it otherwise.
Kieran half closed his eyes. Mark could see crescents of black and silver beneath his lids, fringed by his dark lashes. His hair had paled to almost a pewter color.
I believe you.
He opened his eyes, looked directly into Mark's.
Do you know why I trust you?
Mark shook his head. He could hear the water rushing in the fountain behind them, reminding him of 1,000 rivers they had ridden over together, 1,000 streams they had slept beside.
Because of Christina, said Kieran.
She would not have agreed to a dishonorable plan. I understand you were trying to help your family, your sister. I understand why you were desperate. And I believe you would not have deceived me longer than you needed.
Something behind his eyes suddenly seemed very old.
I will testify, he said.
Mark started up.
Kieran, you don't...
Kieran's hands came up to cup Mark's face. His touch was gentle.
I'm not doing it for you, he said. This will be what I do for Emma and the others. Then that debt will be paid. You and I... Our debts are paid already.
He leaned forward and brushed his lips against Mark's. Mark wanted to chase the kiss, the warmth of it, the familiarity. He felt Kieran's hand come down to splay itself over his chest, over the elf bolt that hung there below his collarbone.
We will be done with each other.
No, Mark whispered.
But Kieran was on his feet, the warmth of his hands gone from Mark's skin. His eyes were dark, his whole body tense. Mark shot to his feet after, meaning to demand that Kieran explain what he had meant by done, just as a terrible noise split the air. It was a noise that came from outside the Institute, though not very far at all, not nearly far enough. A memory flashed through Mark's mind of watching from horseback as a forest of trees was destroyed by lightning. Fire had flashed beneath him. The wrenching crash of branches and trunks like shrieks in his head. Kieran sucked in a breath. His eyes had gone distant, unfocused.
They have come, he said. They are near.
A crash ripped Emma out of sleep and out of Julian's arms. A crash that wasn't quite a crash.
She thought at first that it sounded like two cars slamming into each other on the highway, the screech of brakes and the explosion of glass. It seemed to be coming from right outside. She bolted up and hurtled across the room to the window. There were five of them in the courtyard. They gleamed bronze in the morning light, both horses and riders. The steeds seemed metallic, their eyes bound with bronze silk, their hooves gleaming with a high polish. The fairies who sat astride them were just as shimmering and beautiful, their armor without visible jointure so that it looked like liquid bronze. Their faces were masked, their hair long and metallic. Somehow, here in the heart of London, they looked far more terrifying than they had the first time Emma had seen them. Julian was awake, sitting on the edge of the bed, reaching for the weapons belt that hung on the wall over the nightstand. "They came," she said. "It's the riders." They raced to the library, all of them but Kit and Bridget, as Magnus had instructed. Magnus, Christina, Ty, and Livy were already there when Emma came bursting in with Cortana in her hand. Julian was a few paces behind her. They'd agreed it was better not to seem as if they'd been together. Everyone was standing at the windows, from which the curtains had been drawn back, to provide an uninterrupted view of the courtyard in the front of the Institute. Magnus was leaning against the glass, arm extended, hand flat against the pane, his expression grim. There were black hollows under his eyes, and he looked worryingly gaunt and exhausted. Mark and Kieran came in as Emma hooked her sword over her back and hurried to the windows. Julian slid in beside her and stared through the glass. The five riders hadn't moved from the courtyard. They remained where they were, like statues. Their horses had no reins or bridles, nothing for them to hold. They sat with their swords unsheathed, held out ahead of them like a row of gleaming teeth. Kieran came forward before Mark, crossing the room to the window, and after a moment Mark followed. They stood in a line, the shadow hunters, the warlock, and the fairy prince, staring grimly down at the courtyard. Kieran was silent and sick-looking, his hair a pale white, the color of bones. "They can't get inside the Institute," said Ty. "No," Magnus said. "The wards keep them out." "Nonetheless, we should get away as soon as we can," said Kieran. "I do not trust the riders. They will think of some way in." "We need to contact Alicante," said Livy. "Get them to open their side of a portal so we can get out of here." "We can't do that without revealing that the riders are here and why," said Julian. "But we could still portal away from here, even if we didn't go straight to Idris." He glanced sideways at Magnus. "The thing is, I can't make my side of a portal right now," said Magnus. He spoke with some effort. "We need to hold out a few hours. I've exhausted my energy and wasn't expecting to need to heal Kit or to need to send Alec and the children away." There was an awful silence. It had never occurred to any of them that there were things Magnus couldn't do, that he had a weakness like anyone else. "There's a portal in the crypt," said Ty, "but it only goes to the Cornwall Institute." No one asked him how he knew that. "That institute is abandoned, though," said Julian. "The protections are probably stronger here."
"We'd just be trading institute for institute," said Magnus. "We'd still be trapped inside and with weaker protections. And believe me, they'd be able to follow us. There have never been greater hunters than the riders of Manon."
"What about Katerina Loss?" said Livy. "She got us out of the Los Angeles Institute."
Magnus took a shaky breath. "The same wards keeping the riders out also prevent anyone from trying to make a portal from outside."
"What about the Seely Queen?" Emma said. "Might she be willing to help us fight the riders?"
"The Queen isn't on our side," said Julian. "She's only on her own side." There was a long silence. Magnus broke it.
"I have to hand it to you," he said. "I never thought Jason Clary would be topped by anyone else in terms of insane, self-destructive decisions. But you all are giving them a run for their money."
"I really had nothing to do with this," Kieran pointed out stiffly.
"I think you will find many poor decisions led you here, my friend," Magnus said. "All right. There are a few things I can do to try to bring my energy up. You, all of you, wait here. And don't do anything stupid.
He strode out of the room on long, black-clad legs, swearing under his breath.
He's getting more and more like Gandalf, said Emma, watching him go. I mean, a hot, younger-looking Gandalf. But I keep expecting him to start stroking his long white beard and muttering darkly.
At least he's willing to help us, said Julian.
His gaze sharpened. A rider was coming through the gates. The sixth rider. This one with a slighter build, a spill of long bronze hair. Ethna, Emma thought. The sister. Then her thoughts dissolved into a buzz of shock. A small figure was propped on the bronze horse's back in front of her. A little human girl, with short black hair. She dangled limply in the fairy woman's one-handed grip, but she was blinking, her face twisted in terror. She couldn't have been more than 4 years old. She wore leggings with a cheerful print of bees and bright pink sneakers. In her other hand, Ethna held a dagger, the point of it against the back of the girl's neck. Julian had gone rigid as marble, his face white. Voices rose around Emma in the room, but they were only noise. She couldn't distinguish the words. She was staring at the little girl, and in her mind she saw Drew, Tavi, even Livy and Ty. They'd all been that tiny once, that helpless. And Ethna was strong. All she had to do was drive that dagger forward, and she'd sever the child's head from her neck.
Get back from the window, said Julian. Everyone, get back from the window. If they don't think we're watching them, they're less likely to hurt the girl.
His hand was on Emma's arm. She staggered back with the others. She could hear Mark protesting. They should go down, he was saying. Fight off the riders.
We can't, said Julian in anguish. We'll be slaughtered.
I killed one of them before, said Emma.
They were caught off guard, though. Julian's voice reached her, partially distorted through shock. They didn't expect it, didn't think it was possible. This time they'll be prepared.
He is right, said Karen. Sometimes the most ruthless heart speaks the most truth.
What do you mean? Mark was flushed, his right hand gripping his wrist. Emma realized distantly that the mark of the binding spell was gone from his skin, and from Christina's, too.
The children of Manon have never been defeated, Karen said. Emma is the first ever to slay one. They have taken the child to lure us out, because they know they will have us in their power when we do.
They'll kill her, Emma said. She's a baby.
Emma, Julian reached out for her. She could read his face.
Julian would do anything, brave anything, for his family. There was nothing and no one he wouldn't sacrifice. That was why this had to be her. She bolted. She heard Julian shout her name, but she was out of the library door. She slammed it behind her and took off running down the hall. She was already in gear, already had Cortana. She barreled down the steps, skidding through the entryway, and burst through the front doors of the Institute. She saw the blur of bronze that was the rider's before she swung around and shoved the doors closed, whipping her steely from her pocket. She slashed a locking rune across them just as she heard the dull thumps of bodies striking the other side. Voices calling out to her not to be reckless, to open the doors. Open them, Emma. She put her steely in her pocket, raised Cortana, and descended the steps.
Chapter 28 The Sad Soul.
That's her, Ethna cried, her voice rich and sweet.
She drew the child in her grip closer to her, raised the blade in her hand.
That is the murderer who slew Fowl.
It was a battle, Emma said. He would have killed me.
She looked at the other riders. They stood in their row, facing her, a line of grim statuary.
I would think warriors would know the difference.
You should have been killed like your parents, hissed one of the other riders, Delon. Tortured and carved with knives, like they were.
Emma's heart lurched in her chest. Her fear for the girl was still there, but rage was starting to mix with it.
Let the girl go, she said. Let her go, and you can fight me. Revenge yourselves on me like you want to.
She could hear pounding on the doors behind her. Soon enough, they'd get them open.
She didn't have any illusions of the locking rune holding forever. Her runes had surprising power now, because of Julian. But Julian would be a match for their capability. Emma raised Cortana, the morning sun sliding down the blade like melted butter. "I killed your brother with this sword," she said. "You want revenge? Let the girl go, and I will fight you. Threaten her a moment longer, and I'll go back inside the Institute."
Her eyes flicked from one of them to the other. She thought of her parents, of their bodies, stripped and left on the beach for gulls to pick at.
"We despoiled Fowl's corpse," she lied. "Tore his armor from him, broke his weapon, left him for the rats and crows." Ethna gave a high screech and shoved the small girl away from her. The girl toppled to the ground. Emma gasped, but she found her feet and ran, sobbing for the road. She looked back over her shoulder only once, mouth wide in her tear-stained face as she sprinted to the gate and disappeared. Relief shot through Emma. The girl was safe. And then Ethna charged, her horse's hooves silent on the courtyard stone. She was like a thrown spear, hurtling through the air, noiseless and deadly. Emma bent her knees and sprang, using the height of the steps and the force of her fall to give the swing of her sword power. Their blades clanged together in midair. A shock rattled Emma's bones. Ethna's arm flew wide. Emma landed in a crouch and drove her sword upward, but the fairy woman had already flung herself from the back of her horse. She was on her feet, laughing. The other riders had dismounted as well. Their horses vanished, as if absorbed into the air, as the children of Manon surged toward Emma, blades raised. She lifted herself out of her crouch, Cortana describing a wide arc above her head, striking each sword aside. Emma was reminded of a hand sliding across piano keys, hitting each note in turn. But it was close. The last sword, Delon's, caught Emma's shoulder. She felt her gear rip, her skin sting. Another scar to add to the map of them. She whirled, and Ethna was behind her. She held two short swords, gleaming bronze, and slashed at Emma with the first one and then the other. Emma leapt back, barely in time. If she hadn't been wearing gear, she knew she'd be dead. Her guts spilled out on the flagstones. She felt her jacket tear, and even in the cold of battle, a hot spike of fear went down her spine. This was impossible. No one person could fight six riders. She'd been mad to try. But she thought of the little girl's feet and their pink sneakers and couldn't be sorry. Not even when she turned to find three riders blocking the way back into the Institute. The door of the Institute had stopped shaking. Good, Emma thought. The others should stay safely inside. It was the wise thing to do, the smart thing.
"Your friends have abandoned you,"
sneered one of the riders blocking her way. His bronze hair was short and curling, giving him the look of a Greek chorus. He was lovely. Emma hated his guts.
"Give yourself up now, and we will make your death quick."
"I could give myself a quick death, if that was what I wanted," Emma said, her sword outstretched to hold off the other three fairies. "As it happens..." Ethna was glaring at her. The other riders, she recognized Iremed, if not the others, were whispering. She caught the last few words of a sentence.
"Is the sword as I told you?" "But the rune work cannot harm us," said Iremed, "nor seraph blades."
Emma dove for Ethna. The fairy woman spun, bringing her blades across in a whip-fast slashing gesture. Emma leapt. It was a move she'd practiced over and over with Julian in the training room, using a bar that they raised just a little bit every day. The blades whipped by beneath her feet, and in her mind's eye she saw Julian, his arms raised to catch her. Julian. She landed on the other side of Ethna, whirling and drove her blade into the fairy woman's back. Or tried, at least. Ethna spun at the last moment, and a blade sliced open her bronze armor, opening a gash at her side. She shrieked and staggered back, and Emma jerked Cortana free, blood spattering from the blade onto the flagstones. Emma raised the sword. "This is Cortana," she gasped, her chest heaving. "Of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durandal. There is nothing Cortana cannot cut."
A blade of Waylon the Smith,
cried the rider with the bronze curls, and to Emma's amazement there was fear in his voice.
Silence, Khan, snapped one of the others. It is yet only one blade. Kill her.
Karn's beautiful face contracted. He lifted his weapon, a massive battle axe, and started for Emma. She raised Cortana. And the front door of the Institute burst open, disgorging shadow hunters. Julian. Emma saw him first, a blur of gear and sword and dark hair. Then Mark, Christina, Kieran, Ty, and Livy. And Kit, who seemed to have come from the infirmary, since he seemed to have thrown gear on over his pajamas. At least he was wearing boots. They drove back the riders on the steps, Julian and Mark first, their swords flashing in their hands. Neither of them carried serif blades, Emma saw. They had taken only plain-bladed weapons, unruned, meant for slaying downworlders. Even Kieran carried one, a sword whose pommel and grip gleamed with gold and silver instead of steel. One of the riders let out a roar of rage when he saw Kieran.
Traitor, he snarled.
Kieran dropped a courtly little bow.
Ayo, hate, he said, by way of greeting. And de talum. He winked at the sixth rider, who made a sour face. Well met.
Eochaid lunged for him. Kieran dropped into a half-crouch, swinging his sword with a lightness and skill that surprised Emma. The clash of their blades seemed to signal the beginning of a much larger battle. Julian and Mark had forced the riders from the steps in the first surprise of their appearance. Now the others poured after them, hounding and worrying at them with blades. Mark, carrying a double-edged straight sword, went for Delon. The twins harried Iremed while Christina, looking beyond furious, engaged Itarlum. Julian began to move through the blur of battle, slashing to either side of him, cutting his way toward Emma. His eyes suddenly widened.
Behind you!
She spun. It was Ethna, her face twisted into a mask of hatred. Her blades made a scissoring motion. Emma raised Cortana just in time, and Ethna's double blades closed on it with savage force. And shattered. The ferrywoman gasped in surprise. A second later she was scrambling back, her hands moving in the air. Julian changed course and leapt after her, but another weapon was taking shape in her grasp, this one with a curved blade like a Persian shamshir. Julian's sword slammed against Ethna's. Emma felt the collision between the weapons. It forked through her like lightning. Suddenly everything was happening very fast. Julian twisted gracefully away from the blade, but the edge of it caught him against the top of the arm. Emma felt the pain of it, her parabatai pain, just as she had felt his blade strike Ethna's. She launched herself at the two of them, but Eochaid rose up in front of her, and the point of a sword hurtled toward her face, a silver blur cutting the air. It fell away to one side. Eochaid howled, a brutal, angry sound, and whirled from her to strike savagely at the figure who had come up behind him, whose blade had pierced his shoulder. Blood stained Eochaid's bronze armor. It was Kieran. His hair was a mass of black and white strands, sticky with blood over his temple. His clothes were stained with red, his lips split. He stared at Emma, breathing hard. Eochaid leapt for him and they began to fight savagely. The world seemed a din of clashing blades. Emma heard a cry and saw Christina fighting to get to Kit, who had been knocked to the ground by Delon. The riders had swarmed up the steps to block the Institute doors. Julian was holding off Ethna. The twins were fighting back to back, trying to hack their way up the steps alongside Mark. Emma began to shove blindly toward Kit, a coldness at her heart. The riders were too fierce, too strong. They wouldn't tire. Delon was standing over Kit, his blade high in the air. Kit was scrambling back on his elbows. A sword flashed in front of Emma. She knocked it away with Cortana, heard someone swear. Delon was staring at Kit intently, as if his face held a mystery.
Who are you, boy?
The rider demanded, his blade stilled. Kit wiped blood from his face. There was a dagger near him on the flagstones, just out of reach of his hand.
Christopher Herondale, he said, his eyes flashing arrogantly.
He was a shadow hunter, Emma thought, through and through. He would never beg for his life. Delon snorted.
Qui omnia nomini debes,
he said and began to swing his sword down just as Emma ducked and rolled under the blade, Cortana flashing up, shearing through Delon's wrist. The fairy warrior screamed, an echoing howl of rage and pain. The air was full of a mist of blood. Delon's hand thumped to the ground, still gripping his sword. A second later, Kit was on his feet, snatching up the weapon, his eyes blazing. Emma was beside him. Together, they began to back Delon up, his blood painting the flagstones beneath him as he retreated. But Delon was laughing.
"Slay me if you think you can," he sneered. "But look around you. You have already lost."
Kit had his blade up, pointed directly at Delon's throat.
"You look," he said steadily. "I'll stab."
Emma's head snapped around. Iremed had backed Ty and Livy against the wall. Ethna had a weapon at Julian's throat. Christina had been driven to her knees by Etarlum. Mark was looking at her in horror but couldn't move. Eochaid had his sword against Mark's back, just where he could sever his spine. Karn stood at the top of the steps, his blade out, grinning across his cruel and lovely face. Emma swallowed. Kit swore softly under his breath. Karn spoke, his teeth flashing white with his smile.
"Give us the black volume," he said. "We will let you go."
Kieran stood frozen, staring from Mark to Christina.
"Do not listen," he said. "The riders are wild magic. They can lie."
"We don't have the book," Julian said steadily. "We never had it. Nothing has changed." He looked calm, but Emma could see beneath the surface of him, behind his eyes. She could hear the noise of his thundering heart. He was looking at her, at Mark and Ty and Livy, and he was mortally terrified.
"You are asking for something we cannot do," said Julian. "But maybe we can make a deal. We can swear to you that we will bring you the book when we find it."
"Your oaths mean nothing," snarled Ethna. "Let us kill them now. Send a message to the queen that her tricks will not be countenanced."
Karn laughed.
"Wise words, sister," he said. "Ready your blades."
Emma's hand clamped down on Cortana. Her mind whirled. She couldn't kill them all, couldn't prevent what they were going to do, but by the angel she'd take some of them with her. The gates of the courtyard burst open. They hadn't been locked, but they were flung wide now with such force that, despite their weight, they flew to the sides, slamming into the stone walls of the yard, rattling like sundered chains. Beyond the gate was fog, thick and incongruous on such a sunny day. The violent tableau in the courtyard remained still, arrested in shock, as the fog cleared and a woman stepped into the yard. She was slight and of medium build, her hair a deep brown falling to her waist. She wore a torn shift over a long skirt that didn't fit her well, and a pair of low boots. The bare skin of her arms and shoulders proclaimed her a shadow hunter, with a shadow hunter's scars. The voyance rune decorated her right hand. She held no weapons. Instead, she hugged a book to herself, an old volume bound in dark leather, scuffed and worn. A folded piece of paper was stuck between two pages like a bookmark. She raised her head and looked steadily before her at the scene in the courtyard. Her expression was unsurprised, as if she'd expected nothing else. Emma's heart began to thump. She'd seen this woman before, though it had been on a dark night in Cornwall. She knew her.
"I am Annabel Blackthorne,"
the woman spoke in a clear, even tone, slightly accented.
"The Black Volume is mine."
Eochaid swore. He had a fine-boned, cruel face like an eagle.
"You lied to us,"
he snarled at Emma and the rest.
"You told us you had no idea where the book was."
"Nor did they," said Annabel, still with the same composure. "Malcolm Fade had it, and I took it from his dead body. But it is mine, and always has been mine. It belonged in the library of the house I grew up in. The book has always been Blackthorne property."
"Nevertheless," said Ethna,
though she was looking at Annabelle with a dubious respect. One due the undead, Emma suspected.
You will give it to us, or face the wrath of the Unseelie King.
The Unseelie King, murmured Annabelle. Her face was placid in a way that chilled Emma. Surely no one could be placid in this situation, no one who wasn't insane. Give him my regards. Tell him I know his name. Delon blanched.
His what?
The true name of a fairy gave anyone who knew it power over them. Emma couldn't imagine what it would mean for a king to have his name revealed. His name, Annabelle said. Malcolm was very close to him for many years. He learned your monarch's name. I know it too. If you do not clear off now and return to the king with my message, I will tell it to everyone on the council. I will tell every downworlder. The king is not loved. He will find the results most unpleasant.
She lies, said Iremed, his hawk's eyes slitted.
Risk it with your king, then, she said. Let him find out you are the ones responsible for the revelation of his name.
It would be easy enough to silence you, said Itarlum.
Annabelle did not move as he strode toward her, raising his free hand as if he meant to strike her across the face. He swung, and she caught his wrist, as lightly as a debutante taking her waltz partner's arm during a dance. And she flung him. He sailed across the courtyard and slammed into a wall with a clang of armor. Emma gasped.
Atar!
Ethna cried. She started toward her brother, abandoning Jules, and froze. Her curved sword was rising out of her hand. She reached for it, but it was floating above her head. More cries came from the other riders. Their swords were being jerked out of their grasps, gliding into the air above their heads. Ethna glared at Annabelle.
You fool!
That wasn't her, came a drawling voice from the doorway. It was Magnus, leaning heavily on Drew's shoulder. She seemed to be half-supporting him. Blue fire sparked from his fingers of his free hand. Magnus Bane, High Warlock of Brooklyn, at your service. The riders exchanged glances. Emma knew they could make new weapons easily, but what good would it do them if Magnus just snatched them out of their hands? Their eyes narrowed, their lips curled.
This is not finished,
said Karn as he looked across the courtyard directly at Emma as he said it.
This is not finished between us.
Then he vanished, and the remaining riders followed. One moment they were there, the next gone, winking out of existence like vanishing stars. Their swords crashed to the ground with a loud clang of metal against stone. Hey, muttered Kit, free swords. Magnus gave a low grunt and sagged backward. Drew caught at him, worry in her wide eyes. Get inside now, all of you. They scrambled to obey, the intact pausing to help those who had been injured, though none of the injuries were serious. Emma found Julian without even needing to look for him. Her parabatai senses were still humming. Her body's interior knowledge that he'd been cut would need healing. She slid her arm around him as gently as she could, and he winced. His eyes met hers, and she knew he was feeling her own wound, the cut on the top of her shoulder. She wanted to throw her arms around him, wanted to wipe the blood from his face, kiss his closed eyes. But she knew how that would look. She held herself back with a control that hurt more than her injury did. Julian squeezed her hands and drew away reluctantly. I have to go to Annabelle, he said in a low voice. Emma started. She'd nearly forgotten Annabelle, but she was still there, in the center of the courtyard, the black volume hugged to her chest. The others stood around her uncertainly. After all the time spent looking for Annabelle, it was clear no one had ever imagined she would come to them. Even Julian paused before he reached her, hesitating as if deciding how to break the silence. Near him, Ty stood between Livy and Kit, all of them staring at Annabelle as if she were an apparition and not really there at all. Annabelle,
It was Magnus. He had limped down the steps to the bottom. He only had a light hand on Drew's shoulder now, though there were dark crescents of exhaustion below his eyes. He sounded sad, that depthless sort of sadness that came out of a time, a life that Emma could not even imagine.
"Oh, Annabelle, why did you come here?"
Annabelle drew the folded piece of paper from a black volume.
"I received a letter," she said in a voice so soft it was barely audible, "from Tiberius Blackthorn."
Only Kit didn't look surprised. He put his hand on Ty's arm as Tiberius scanned the ground furiously.
"There was something in it," she said. "I had thought the world's hand turned against me. But as I read the letter, I imagined there was a chance it was not so."
She raised her chin, that characteristic defiant Blackthorn gesture that broke Emma's heart every time.
"I have come to speak with Julian Blackthorn about the Black Volume of the Dead."
"There is an undead person in our library," said Livy. She was sitting on one of the long beds in the infirmary. They'd all gathered there, all but Magnus, who had clothed himself into the library with Annabelle. They were in varying stages of being ruined and patched up and cleaned. There was a small pile of bloody cloths growing on the counter. Ty was on the same bed as Livy, his back to the headboard. As always, after a battle, Emma noticed, he had withdrawn a bit, as if he needed time to recuperate from the clang and shock of it. He was twisting something between his fingers in regular rhythmic motions, though Emma couldn't see what it was. "It's not our library," he said. "It's Evelyn's." "Still strange," Livy said. Neither she nor Ty had been injured in the fight, but Kit had, and she was finishing an erotzi on his back. "All done," she said, patting his shoulder, and he drew his T-shirt down with a wince.
"She isn't undead, not actually," said Julian.
Emma had given him an erotzi, but some part of her had become afraid of drawing runes on him, and she'd stopped there, bandaging the wound instead. He'd had a long cut running down his upper arm, and even after he'd pulled his shirt back on, the bandages were visible through the fabric.
"She's not a zombie or a ghost."
One of the glasses of water on the nightstand fell over with a crash.
"Jessamine didn't appreciate that," said Kit.
Christina laughed. She wasn't injured either, but she was worrying at the pendant around her throat as she watched Mark tend to Kieran's injuries. Hunters healed faster, Emma knew, but they also bruised easily, it seemed. A map of blue-black spread over Kieran's back and shoulders, and one of his cheekbones was darkening. With a cloth that Christina had wet down in one of his hands, Mark was gently sponging away the blood. The elf bolt gleamed around Mark's neck.
Emma didn't know what was going on with Mark and Kieran and Christina exactly. Christina had been remarkably reluctant to explain, but she knew Kieran had learned the truth about his and Mark's relationship. Still, Kieran hadn't taken his elf bolt back, so that was something. She realized with a small jolt of surprise that she was hoping things worked out for them. She hoped that wasn't disloyal to Christina, but she was no longer angry at Kieran. He might have made a mistake, but he'd made up for it many times over since then.
"Where was Jessamine earlier?" said Julian. "Isn't she supposed to protect the Institute?" Another crash of glass.
"She says she can't leave the Institute. She can only protect it from inside." Kit paused.
"I don't know if I should repeat the rest of what she said." After a moment, he smiled.
"Thank you, Jessamine."
"What did she say?" Livy asked, picking up her steely.
"That I'm a true Herondale," he said. He frowned.
"What did that metal guy say to me when I told him my name? Was it fairy language?"
"Oddly, it was Latin," said Julian. "An insult, something Mark Antony once said to Augustus Caesar.
You, boy, who owe everything to a name."
He was saying he never would have amounted to anything if he hadn't been a Caesar. Kit looked annoyed. "I've been a Herondale for like 3 weeks," he said. "I'm not sure what I've gotten out of it."
"Do not pay too much attention to the pronouncements of fairies," said Kieran.
"They will get under your skin in any way they can."
"Does that include you?" asked Christina with a smile.
"Obviously," said Kieran, and he smiled too, just slightly.
Theirs might be the weirdest friendship she'd ever seen, Emma thought. We're off topic, said Livy. Annabelle Blackthorne is in our library. That's weird, right? Doesn't anyone else think it's weird? Why is that weirder than vampires, said Ty, clearly perplexed. Or werewolves. Well, of course you wouldn't think it was, said Kit. You're the one who told her to come.
Yes, about that, Julian began. Is there a particular reason you didn't tell any of us?
Ty was saved from a brotherly chastisement by the infirmary door opening.
It was Magnus. Emma didn't like the way he looked. He seemed grimly pale, his eyes shadowed, his movements stiff as if he were bruised. His mouth was set in a serious line.
Julian, he said, if you could come with me.
What for? Asked Emma.
I've been trying to talk to Annabelle, Magnus said. I thought she might be willing to open up to someone who wasn't a shadow hunter if she had the option, but she's stubborn.
She stayed polite, but she says she'll only speak to Julian. Does she not remember you? Julian asked, getting up.
She remembers me, said Magnus, but as a friend of Malcolm's, and she's not his biggest fan these days.
Ungrateful, Emma remembered Kieran saying, but he was silent now, rebuttoning his torn shirt, his bruised eyes cast downward.
Why doesn't she want to talk to Ty? Said Livy. He sent her the message.
Magnus shrugged, and I couldn't tell you, shrug.
All right, I'll be right back, said Julian. We're leaving for Idris as soon as possible, so everyone grab anything they might need to take with them.
The council meeting is this afternoon, Magnus said. I'll have the strength to make a portal in a few hours. We'll be sleeping in Alicante tonight.
He sounded relieved about it. He and Julian headed out into the hallway. Emma meant to hang back, but she couldn't. She darted after them before the door closed.
Jules, she said.
He had already started down the corridor with Magnus. At the sound of her voice, they both turned. She couldn't have done it in the infirmary, but it was just Magnus, and he already knew. She went up to Julian and put her arms around him.
Be careful, she said. She sent us into a trap in that church. This could be a trap, too.
I'll be right there, outside the room, Magnus said, subdued. I'll be ready to intervene. But, Julian, under no circumstances should you try to take the black volume from her, even if she isn't holding it. It's tied to her with pretty powerful magic.
Julian nodded, and Magnus disappeared down the hallway, leaving them alone. For long moments, they held each other in silence, letting the anxiety of the day dissipate, their fear for each other in the battle, their fear for the children, their worry over what was going to happen in Alicante. Julian was warm and solid in her arms, his hand tracing a soothing line down her back. He smelled of cloves, as always, as well as antiseptic and bandages. She felt his chin nudge her hair as his fingers flew across the back of her shirt. D-O-N-T-W-O-R-R-Y.
Of course I'm worried, said Emma. You saw what she did to Atarlum. Do you think you can convince her to just give you the book?
I don't know, Julian said. I'll know when I talk to her.
Annabelle's been lied to so much, said Emma. Don't promise anything we can't deliver.
He kissed her forehead. His lips moved against her skin, his voice so low that no one who didn't know him as well as Emma did could have understood him at all.
I will do, he said, whatever I need to do.
She knew he meant it. There was nothing more to say. She watched him go down the corridor toward the library with troubled eyes. Kit was in his room packing his meager belongings when Livy came in. She dressed for the trip to Idris in a long black skirt and a round-collared white shirt. Her hair was loose down her back. She looked at Ty, sitting on Kit's bed. They had been discussing Idris and what Ty remembered of it.
It's not like any place else, he told Kit.
But when you get there, you'll feel like you've been there before.
Ty, Livy said. Bridget says you can take one of the old Sherlock Holmes books from the library and keep it.
Ty's face lit up.
Which one?
Whichever you want. Your choice. Just hurry up. We're going to leave as soon as we can, Magnus said.
Ty bounded to the door, seemed to remember Kit, and swung back around.
We can talk more later, he said, and darted down the hallway.
Only one book. One! Libby called after him with a laugh.
Ouch!
She reached up to fiddle with something at the back of her neck. Her face crinkled in annoyance.
My necklace is caught on my hair.
Kit reached up to untangle the thin gold chain. A locket dangled from it, kissing the hollow of her throat. Up close, she smelled like orange blossoms. Their faces were very close together, and the pale curve of her mouth was near his. Her lips were light rose pink. Confusion stirred in Kit. It was Livy who shook her head.
We shouldn't, Kit. No more kissing. I mean, we only did it once anyway. But I don't think that's how we're meant to be.
The necklace came free. Kit drew his hands away quickly, confused.
Why? He asked. Did I do something wrong?
Not even a little. She looked at him for a moment with her wise and thoughtful eyes. There was a soft happiness in Livy that drew Kit, but not in a romantic way. She was right, and he knew it.
Everything's great.
Ty even says he thinks we should be parabatai after all this is cleared up. Her face glowed.
I hope you'll come to the ceremony, and you'll always be my friend, right?
Of course, he said. And only later did he stop to think that she had said my friend and not our friend, hers and Ty's. Right now he was just relieved that he didn't feel hurt or bothered by her decision. He felt instead a pleasant anticipation of getting through this council meeting and going home, back to Los Angeles, where he could start his training and have the twins help him through the rough parts. Friends always. Julian felt a twist of apprehension in his stomach as he entered the library. Part of him half expected Annabelle to have vanished, or to be drifting around the stacks of books like a long-haired ghost in a horror movie. He'd seen one once, where the ghost of a girl had crawled out of a well, her pale face hidden behind masses of wet, dark hair. The memory gave him shivers even now. The library was well illuminated by its rows of green banker's lamps. Annabelle sat at the longest table, the black volume in front of her, her hands clasped in her lap. Her hair was long and dark and half hid her face, but it wasn't wet and there wasn't anything obviously uncanny about her. She looked ordinary. He sat down across from her. Magnus must have brought her something to wear from the storage room. She was in a very plain blue dress, a little short in the sleeves. Julian guessed she'd been around 19 when she died, maybe 20.
That was quite a trick you pulled, he said.
With the note in the church, and the demon.
I didn't expect you to burn the church down.
That pronounced accent was back in her voice, the strangeness of a way of speaking long outdated now.
You surprised me.
And you've surprised me, coming here, Julian said, and saying you'd only talk to me. You don't even like me, I thought.
I came because of this.
She drew the folded paper from the book and held it out to him. Her fingers were long, the joints strangely misshapen. He realized he was looking at evidence that her fingers had been broken more than once, and that the bones had knit back together oddly.
The visible remnants of torture.
He felt a little sick as he took the letter and opened it.
To Annabelle Blackthorne.
Annabelle, you might not know me, but we are related. My name is Tiberius Blackthorne. My family and I are looking for the Black Volume of the Dead. We know you have it, because my brother Julian saw you take it from Malcolm Fade. I'm not blaming you. Malcolm Fade is not our friend. He tried to hurt our family, to destroy us if he could. He's a monster. But the thing is, we need the book now. We need it so we can save our family. We're a good family. You would like us if you knew us. There's me. I'm going to be a detective. There's Livy, my twin, who can fence, and Drusilla, who loves everything scary, and Tavi, who likes stories read to him. There is Mark, who is part fairy. He's an excellent cook. There is Helen, who was exiled to guard the wards, but not because she did anything wrong. And Emma, who isn't strictly a Blackthorn, but she's like an extra sister anyway. And there's Jules. You might like him the best. He is the one who takes care of us all. He is the reason we're all okay and still together.
I don't think he knows we know that, but we do. Sometimes he might tell us what to do, or not listen, but he would do anything for any of us. People say we're unlucky because we don't have parents, but I think they're unlucky because they don't have a brother like mine. Julian had to stop there. The pressure behind his eyes had built to a shattering intensity. He wanted to put his head down on the table and burst into unmanly, undignified tears. For the boy he had been, scared and terrified and 12 years old, looking at his younger brothers and sisters and thinking, they're mine now. For them, their faith in him, their expectation his love would be unconditional, that he wouldn't need to be told he was loved back because of course he was. Ty thought this about him, and probably thought it was obvious, but he had never guessed.
He forced himself to stay silent, to keep his face expressionless. He laid the letter down on the table so that the shaking of his hand was less visible. There was only a little writing left. Don't think I'm asking you to do us a favor for nothing in return. Julian can help you. He can help anyone. You can't want to be running and hiding. I know what happened to you, what the Clave and Council did. Things are different now. Let us explain. Let us show you how you don't have to be exiled or alone. You don't have to give us the book. We just want to help. We're at the London Institute. Whenever you want to come, you'd be welcome. Yours, Tiberius Nero Blackthorne. How does he know what happened to me? Annabelle didn't sound angry, only curious. Well, the Inquisitor and the others did to me. Julian got to his feet and went across the room to where the Alethea crystal rested on a bookcase. He brought it back and gave it to her. Ty found this in Blackthorn Hall, he said. These are someone's memories of your trials in the council chamber. Annabelle raised the crystal to eye level. Julian had never seen the expression of someone looking into an Alethea crystal before.
Her eyes widened, tracking back and forth as she gazed at the scene moving before her.
Her cheeks flushed. Her lips shook. Her hand began to jerk uncontrollably, and she flung the crystal away from her. It hit the table, denting the wood without breaking.
Oh, God. Is there to be no mercy? She said in an empty voice. Will there never be any mercy or forgetfulness?
Not while this is still an injustice. Julian's heart was beating hard, but he knew he showed no outward signs of agitation. It will always hurt as long as they haven't recompensed you for what they did. She raised her eyes to his.
What do you mean? Come with me to Idris, Julian said. Testify in front of the council, and I will see to it you get justice. She turned pale and swayed slightly. Julian half rose from his chair. He reached for her and stopped. Maybe she didn't want to be touched. And there was part of him that didn't want to touch her. He'd seen her when she was a skeleton, held together with a fragile cobwebbing of yellowed skin and tendon. She looked real and solid and alive now, but he couldn't help but feel his hand would pass through her skin and strike crumbling bone beneath. He drew his hand back.
You cannot offer me justice, she said. You cannot offer me anything I want. Julian felt cold all over, but he could not deny the excitement sparking through his nerves. He saw the plan suddenly in front of him, the strategy of it. The excitement of that overrode even the chill of the razor's edge he was walking. I never told anyone you were in Cornwall, he said. Even after the church, I kept your secret. You can trust me. She looked at him with wide eyes. This was why he had done it, Julian thought. He had kept this information to himself as possible leverage, even when he hadn't known for sure that there would ever be a moment he could use it. Emma's voice whispered in his head. Julian, you scared me a little. I wanted to show you something, Julian said, and drew from his jacket a rolled-up paper. He handed it across the table to Annabelle. It was a drawing he had done of Emma on Chapel Cliff, the sea breaking under her feet. He had been pleased with the way he had captured the wistful look on her face, the sea thick as paint below her, the weak sun gray-gold on her hair. "Emma Carstairs, my parabatai," said Julian. Annabel raised grave eyes. "Malcolm spoke of her. He said she was stubborn. He spoke of all of you. Malcolm was afraid of you." Julian was stunned. "Why?" "He said what Tiberius said. He said you would do anything for your family." "You have a ruthless heart." Julian pushed away the words Kieran had said to him. He couldn't be distracted. This was too important. "What else can you tell from the picture?" he said. "That you love her," said Annabel, "with all of your soul." There was nothing suspicious in her gaze. Parabatai were meant to love each other. Julian could see the prize, the solution. Kieran's testimony was one piece of the puzzle. It would help them. But the cohort would object to it, to any alliance with fairies. Annabel was the key to destroying the cohort and ensuring the safety of the Blackthorns. Julian could see the image of his family safe. Aline and Helen returned, in front of him like a shimmering city on a hill. He went toward it, thinking of nothing else. "I saw your sketches and paintings," he said. "I could tell from them what you loved." "Malcolm," she said with her eyebrows raised, "but that was a long time ago." "Not Malcolm. Blackthorn Manor. The one in Idris, where you lived when you were a child. All your drawings of it were alive, like you could see it in your mind, touch it with your hand, be there in your heart." She laid his sketch down on the table. She was silent. "You could get that back," he said. "The manor house, all of it. I know why you ran. You expected that if the Clave caught you, they'd punish you, hurt you again. But I can promise you they won't. They're not perfect. They're far from perfect. But this is a new Clave and council. Downworlders sit on our council." Her eyes flew open. "Magnus said that, but I didn't believe him." "It's true. Marriage between a downworlder and a shadow hunter isn't illegal anymore. If we bring you before the Clave, they won't just not hurt you. You'll be reinstated. You'll be a shadow hunter again. You can live in Blackthorn Manor. We'd give it to you." "Why?" She rose to her feet and began to pace. "Why would you do all that for me? For the book? Because I will not give it to you." "Because I need you to stand in front of the council and say that you killed Malcolm," he told her. She had left the black volume on the table before him. She was still pacing, not looking at him. Recalling Magnus's warning, "Under no circumstances should you try to take the black volume from her, even if she isn't holding it." Julian opened it cautiously, peered at a page of cramped, unreadable lettering. An idea was beginning to unfurl inside his mind like a cautious flower. He reached into his pocket. "Did I kill Malcolm?" She spun to stare at him. He had his phone out, but he suspected it meant nothing to her. She'd probably seen mundanes wandering around with cell phones, but she'd never think of it as a camera. In fact, a camera wouldn't mean anything to her either. "Yes," he said. "Believe me, he'd be hailed as a hero." She'd begun pacing again. Julian's shoulders ached. The position he was in, both hands occupied and leaning forward, was an awkward one. But if this worked, it would be more than worth the pain. "There is someone who is lying," he said, "taking credit for Malcolm's death. She is doing it so that she can get control of an institute, our institute." He took a deep breath. "Her name is Zara Dearborn." The name electrified her, as he had suspected it would. "Dearborn?" she breathed. "The Inquisitor who tortured you," said Julian. "His descendants are no better. They will all be there now, carrying their signs, shaming downworlders, shaming those who stand up to the Clave. They will bring an awful darkness down on us. But you can prove them liars, discredit them."
"Surely you could tell them the truth."
"Not without revealing how I know. I saw you kill Malcolm in the Seelie Queen's scrying glass. I'm telling you this because I'm desperate. If you heard Malcolm speaking of the cold piece, you must know contact with fairies is forbidden. What I did would be considered treason. I'd take the punishment for it, but...
Your brothers and sisters couldn't bear that, she finished for him.
She turned back toward him just as he leaned away from the book. Were her eyes more like Livy's or Drew's? They were blue-green and depthless.
I see things have not changed as much as all that. The law is still hard, and is still the law.
Julian could hear the hate in her voice, and knew he had her. But the law can be circumvented. He leaned across the table. We can trick them, and shame them, force them to confront their lies. The Dearborns will pay. They'll all be there. The consul, the inquisitor, all those who inherited the power that was abused when they hurt you. Her eyes glittered.
You will make them acknowledge it? What they did?
Yes.
And in return?
Your testimony, he said. That's all.
You wish me to come to Idris with you, to stand before the Crave and the Council, and the Inquisitor, as I did before?
Julian nodded.
And if they call me mad, if they declare I'm lying, or under Malcolm's duress, you will stand for me? You will insist I am sane?
Magnus will be with you every step of the way, Julian said. He can stand beside you on the dais. He can protect you. He is the warlock representative on the council, and you know how powerful he is. You can trust him, even if you don't trust me. It was not a real answer, but she took it for one. Julian had known she would.
I do trust you, she said with wonder. She came forward and picked up the black volume, hugging it to her chest. Because of your brother's letter. It was honest. I had not thought of an honest Blackthorn before, but I could hear the truth in how he loves you. You must be worthy of such love and trust to have inspired it in one so truthful. Her eyes bored into him. I know what you want, what you need. And yet now that I've come to you, you have not once asked for it. That should count for something. Though you failed my trial, I understand it now. You are acting for your family.
He could see her swallow, the muscles in her thin, scarred throat.
You swear that if the Black Volume is given to you, you will keep it hidden from the Lord of Shadows? You'll use it only to help your family?
I swear on the Angel, said Julian. He knew how powerful an oath on the Angel was, and Annabelle would know it too. But he was speaking only the truth, after all. His heart was beating in swift and powerful hammer blows. He was blinded by the light of what he could imagine, what the Queen could do for them if they gave her the Black Volume.
Helen could come back, and Aline, and the cold peace could end. And the Queen knows. She knows.
He forced the thought back. He could hear Emma's voice, a whisper in the back of his mind, a warning. But Emma was good in her heart, honest, straightforward, a terrible liar. She didn't understand the brutality of need, the absoluteness of what he would do for his family. There was no end to its depth and breadth. It was total.
Very well, Annabelle said. Her voice was strong, forceful. You could hear the unbreakable cliffs of Cornwall in her accent. I will come with you to the City of Glass and speak before the council. And if I am acknowledged, then the Black Volume will be yours.
Chapter 29 Ultima Thule. The sun was shining in Alicante. The first time Emma had been in Idris, it had been winter, cold as death, and there had been death all around. Her parents had just been killed, and the Dark War had ravaged the city. They hadn't been able to burn the bodies of shadow hunters killed in the streets fast enough, and the corpses had stacked up in the hall like discarded children's toys.
Emma?
Julian was pacing the long corridor in the guard, lined with doors, each leading into the office of a different official. Alternating between the doors were windows letting in the bright light of late summer, and tapestries depicting significant events in Shadowhunter history. Most had small woven banners across the tops, describing what they were. the Battle of the Bund, Valentine's last stand, the Paris engagement, the uprising.
Do you remember?
She did remember. They'd stood in this exact place 5 years ago, listening to Lucian Greymark and Gia Penhallow discuss the exile of Mark and Helen, before Emma had thrown open the door to shout at them. It was one of the few times she'd seen Julian lose control. She could hear his voice in her head, even now.
You promised the Clave would never abandon Mark while he was living. You promised!
Like I could forget, she said. This is where we told the Consul we wanted to be Parabatai. Julian touched her hand with his. It was only a brush of fingers. They were both conscious anyone could come down the corridor at any moment. Getting to Alicante had been difficult. Magnus had managed the portal, though it seemed to have taken the last of his energy in a way that frightened Emma. He had been kneeling by the time the familiar swirling lights had formed, and he'd had to lean on Mark and Julian to rise. Still, he had brushed off all concerns and informed them that they needed to go through the portal quickly. Idris was warded, and portaling there was a complex business, since someone had to be on the other side to receive you. It was doubly complex now, since Kieran was with them. And though Gia had waived the anti-fairy protections on the guard temporarily, the window for safe travel was short. Then, the portal had terrified Annabelle. She had never seen one before. And despite everything she'd been through, despite all the awful magic she'd seen Malcolm wreak, the sight of the whirling chaos inside the doorway made her scream. In the end, after the Shadow Hunters had all entered the portal, she went through with Magnus, clutching the black volume in her hands, her face hidden against his shoulder. Only to be met on the other side by a crowd of council members and the consul herself. Gia had blanched when she saw Annabelle and said in an astonished voice, "Is that really her?" Magnus had locked eyes with the consul for a moment. "Yes," he said firmly. "It is. She is." There was a babble of questions. Emma couldn't blame the assembled council members. There had been quite a few questions for Julian when he'd emerged from the library and told awaiting Magnus and Emma that Annabelle was coming with them to Idris. As he'd outlined his plan, Emma had caught sight of the expression on Magnus's face. The warlock had looked at Julian with a mixture of astonishment, respect, and something that might have looked a little like horror. But it had probably just been surprise. After all, Magnus had seemed sanguine enough, and had immediately set about sending a fire message to Gia to let her know what to expect. Emma had drawn Julian aside while blue sparks flew from Magnus's fingers.
"What about the book?" she'd whispered. "What about the queen?"
Julian's eyes glittered. "If this works, Annabelle will give us the black volume," he replied in a whisper, and he'd been looking at the library door as if Annabelle behind it were the answer to all their prayers. "And if not, I have a plan for that too." There'd been no chance to ask him what the plan was. Annabelle had stepped out of the library, looking fearful and shy. She looked even more fearful now as the hubbub rose around her. Kieran drew some of the fire by stepping up to announce himself as the envoy of the Seelie Queen, sent to speak on behalf of the Seelie Court to the Council of Shadow Hunters. He had been expected, but there was still a burst of more excited talking. "Put the wards back up," said the consul, inclining her head to Kieran. Her expression was polite, but the message was clear. Though Kieran was there to help them, all full-blooded fairies were still going to be treated with extreme suspicion by the Clave. Mark and Christina moved to Kieran's side protectively, while Magnus spoke quietly with the consul. After a moment, she nodded and gestured at Emma and Julian. "If you want to speak to Robert, go ahead," she said. "But keep it short. The meeting is soon." Emma was unsurprised as she and Julian headed toward the guards' offices to see that Livy, Ty, Kit, and Drew had flanked Annabelle protectively. Ty, especially, had his chin jutting out, his hands and fists. Emma wondered if he felt responsible for Annabelle because his letter had brought her to them, or if he felt some kind of kinship for those at odds with the Clave standards for normalcy. A door swung open.
"You can come in now," said a guard. It was Manuel Villalobos wearing his Centaurian uniform.
His start of surprise at seeing them was quickly hidden by a smirk. "An unexpected pleasure," he said. "We're not here to see you," said Julian. "Oh, nice to know you're opening doors for the Inquisitor these days. Is he here?"
"Let them in, Centaurian," Robert called, which was all the permission needed for Emma to shove by Manuel and stalk down the hallway. Julian followed her.
The short hall ended in the Inquisitor's office. He was sitting behind his desk, looking much the same as he had last time Emma had seen him at the Los Angeles Institute. A big man, only now beginning to show the marks of age. His shoulders were a little hunched, his dark hair woven thickly with gray. Robert Lightwood cut an imposing figure behind his massive mahogany desk. The room was largely unfurnished, aside from a desk and two chairs. There was an unlit fireplace, above whose mantle hung one of the series of tapestries on display in the hall outside. This one said, "The Battle of the Burren." Figures in red clashed with figures in black, shadow hunters and the undarkened ones, and above the melee, a dark-haired archer was visible standing on a tipped boulder, holding a drawn bow and arrow. To anyone who knew him, it was very clearly Alec Lightwood. Emma wondered what thoughts went through Robert Lightwood's mind as he sat each day in his office and looked at the portrait of his son, a hero of a now-famous battle. Pride, of course. But there must also be some wonder that he had created this person. These people, really, for Isabel Lightwood was no slouch in the heroics department, who had become so fierce and amazing in their own right. Someday Julian would have that pride, she thought, in Livy and Ty and Tavi and Drew. But her parents had never had the chance to feel it. She'd never had the chance to make them proud. She felt the familiar wave of bitterness and resentment pressing against her heart. Robert gestured for them to be seated.
"I hear you want to talk to me," he said. "I hope this isn't meant to be some sort of distraction."
"Distraction from what?" Emma asked, settling herself into the uncomfortable wing-back chair.
"Whatever you're up to," he sat back.
"So, what is it?" Emma's heart seemed to flip. Was this a good idea or a terrible one? It felt as if everything in her had been armoring against this moment, against the idea that she and Julian would have to spread their feelings out under the feet of the Clave for them to tread on. She watched Julian as he leaned forward and began to speak. He seemed absolutely calm as he spoke of his and Emma's early friendship, their affection for each other, their decision to be parabatai, brought on by the Dark War and the loss of their parents. He made it sound like a reasonable decision, no one's fault. Who could have blamed them, any of them? The Dark War had stricken them all with loss. No one could be at fault for overlooking details, for mistaking their feelings. Robert Lightwood's eyes began to widen. He listened in silence as Julian spoke of his and Emma's growing feelings for each other. How they both had realized what they felt separately, struggled in silence, confessed their emotions, and finally decided to seek the Inquisitor's assistance, and even the exercise of the law. "We know we've broken the law," Julian finished. "But it was not intentional, or under our control. All we want is your help." Robert Lightwood got to his feet. Emma could see the glass towers through his window, glimmering like burning banners. She could hardly believe that just that morning they'd been fighting the riders in the courtyard of the London Institute. "No one's ever asked me if they could be exiled before," he said finally.
"But you were exiled yourself once," said Julian.
"Yes," Robert said, "with my wife Maris and Alec when he was a toddler, and for good reason. It's a lonely thing, exile, and for someone as young as Emma," he glanced at them. "Does anyone else know about you?"
"No," Julian's voice was calm and firm.
Emma knew he was trying to protect those who had guessed or had been told, but it unnerved her anyway, the way he could sound so absolutely sincere when he was lying.
"And you're sure? This isn't a crush, or just..."
"Parabatai feelings can be very intense," Robert sounded awkward as he clasped his hands behind his back. "They're easy to misconstrue."
"We," said Julian, "are absolutely sure."
"The usual measure would be separation, not exile.
Robert looked from one of them to the other as if he still couldn't quite believe what was in front of him. But you don't want that. I could see that already. You wouldn't have come to me if you thought I could only offer you the standard measures. Separation, stripping of your marks.
We can't risk breaking the law and the punishments that entails. Julian's voice was still calm, but Emma could see his hands, white-knuckled, gripping his chair arms. My family needs me. My brothers and sisters are still young, and they have no parents. I've raised them, and I can't leave them. It's out of the question. But Emma and I know we can't trust ourselves just to stay away from each other.
So, you want to be separated by the Clave, said Robert. You want exile, but you don't want to wait to be caught. You've come to me so you can choose which of you leaves, and for how long, and what punishment the Clave, directed by me, will decide on.
Yes, said Julian.
And though you're not saying it, I think you want some of what exile will do for you, said Robert. It'll deaden your bond. Maybe you think it'll make it easier for you to stop loving each other.
Neither Emma or Julian spoke. He was uncomfortably close to the truth. Julian was expressionless. Emma tried to school her features to match his. Robert was tapping his fingertips together.
We just want to be able to be normal Parabatai, said Julian finally. But Emma could hear the silent words beneath the audible ones. We will never give each other up. Never.
It's quite something to ask. Emma strained to hear anger or reproach or disbelief in the Inquisitor's voice, but he sounded neutral. It frightened her.
You had a Parabatai, she said in desperation, didn't you?
Michael Wayland. Robert's tone was wintry. He died.
I'm so sorry.
Emma had known that, but the sympathy was sincere. She could imagine little more horrible than Julian dying.
I bet he would have wanted you to help us, Julian said.
Emma had no idea if he spoke from knowledge of Michael Wayland or just intuition, that skill he had of reading the look in people's eyes, the truth in the way they frowned or smiled.
Michael would have, yes, Robert muttered. He would have, by the angel.
Exile will be a heavy burden for you, Emma. I can try to limit the terms of the punishment, but you'll still lose some of your Nephilim powers. You'll need permission to enter Alicante. There'll be some marks you can't use. Seraph Blaze won't light for you.
I have Cortana, said Emma. That's all I need.
There was sadness in Robert's smile.
If there's a war, you can't fight in it. That's why my exile was lifted, because Valentine returned and began the mortal war.
Julian's expression was so tight that his cheekbones seemed to stand out like knife blades.
We won't accept the exile unless Emma's allowed to keep enough of her Nephilim power to be safe, he said. If she's hurt because of this exile.
The exile is your idea, said Robert. Are you sure you'll be able to fall out of love?
Yes. Julian lied.
Separation would be the first move anyway, wouldn't it? We're just asking for a little extra surety.
I've heard things, Robert said. The law against Parabatai falling in love exists for a reason.
I don't know the reason, but my guess is that it's significant.
If I thought you knew what it was,
he shook his head.
But you can't, possibly.
I could speak with the Silent Brothers.
No, Emma thought. They'd risked so much already. But if Robert learned of the curse, they'd be in very dangerous waters.
Magnus said you would help us, she said in a soft voice. He said we could trust you, and that you'd understand and keep it a secret.
Robert looked up at the tapestry that hung over his mantle, at Alec. He touched the lightwood ring on his finger, a likely unconscious gesture.
I trust Magnus, he said, and I owe him. A great deal.
His gaze was distant. Emma wasn't sure if he was thinking about the past or considering the future. She and Julian sat tensely while he considered. Finally, he said, All right. Give me a few days. The two of you will have to remain in Alicante while I look into managing the exile ceremony. And you must stay in separate houses. I need to see a good faith effort to avoid each other. Is that clear?
Emma swallowed hard. The exile ceremony. She hoped Jem could be there. Silent Brothers were the ones who presided over ceremonies, and even though he no longer was one, he had been at her parabatai ceremony with Julian. If he could be there for this, she would feel a little less alone. She could see Julian's expression. He looked much as she felt, as if relief and dread were warring inside him. "Thank you," he said. "Thank you, Inquisitor," she echoed, and Robert looked surprised. She suspected no one ever thanked him for a sentence of exile before. Christina had never been in the guards' council hall before. It was a horseshoe-shaped space, rows of benches marching toward a slightly raised dais, a second balcony level, containing more benches and seats rose high above. Above the dais hung a huge golden clock, gorgeously made with delicate scrollwork and a repeated Latin phrase, Ultima Thule, marching around the rim. Behind the dais was an incredible wall of windows, giving out onto a view of Alicante below. She raised herself a little bit on tiptoe to see the winding streets, the blue slashes of the canals, the demon towers rising like clear needles against the sky. The hall was beginning to fill. Annabelle and Kieran had been taken to a waiting room, along with Magnus. The rest of them had been allowed in early and had claimed two rows of benches near the front. Ty, Kit, and Livy were sitting, engaged in conversation. Drew sat quietly on her own, seeming lost in thought. Christina was about to start toward her when she felt a light tap on her shoulder. It was Mark. He had dressed carefully for the council visit, and she felt a pang as she looked at him. He was so gorgeous in his pressed, old-fashioned clothes, like a marvelously colored old photograph. The dark jacket and waistcoat fit him well, and he had brushed his blonde hair so that it covered the tips of his ears. He had even shaved and nicked himself slightly on the chin, which was ridiculous because Mark had no facial hair to speak of. He looked to Christina like a little boy wanting to make a good impression on the first day of school. Her heart went out to him. He cared so much about the good opinion of a group of people who had agreed to abandon him to the Wild Hunt, despite the pleas of his family, just because of who he was. "Do you think Kieran will be all right?" Mark said. "They ought to treat the envoy from the court with more honor. Instead, they practically ran to put the wards back up as soon as we arrived." "He'll be fine," Christina assured him. Both Kieran and Mark, she thought, were stronger than the other one could believe, maybe because they'd been so vulnerable in the hunt. Though I can't imagine Annabelle is much of a conversationalist. At least Magnus is with them. Mark gave a strained smile as a low murmur swept through the room. The Centaurians had arrived in full dress. They wore their uniforms of red, gray, and silver, and their silver pins on display. Each carried a staff of solid adamas. Christina recognized some from Los Angeles, like Zara's friend Samantha, with her thin, nasty face, and Rayan looking around the room with an expression of concern. Zara led the procession, her head held high, her mouth a slash of bright red. Her lips curled in distaste as she passed Mark and Christina. But why wasn't Diego beside her? Had he not come with them? But no, there he was, almost at the end of the line, looking gray and tired, but definitely present. He paused in front of Mark and Christina as the other Centaurians passed by. "I got your message," he said to Christina in a low voice. "If it's what you want." "What message?" Mark said. "What's going on?" Zara appeared at Diego's side. "A reunion," she said. "How nice." She smiled at Christina. "I'm sure you'll all be pleased to hear how well everything went in Los Angeles after you left." "Very impressive of you, killing Malcolm," said Mark. His eyes were flat and glittering. "It seems to have resulted in quite a bit of advancement. Well earned, I'm sure." "Thank you," Zara laughed breathlessly, laying her hand on Diego's arm. "Oh," she said with a sharply artificial enthusiasm, "look." More shadow hunters had entered the room. They were a mix of ages, from old to young. Some wore Centaurian uniforms. Most wore gear or ordinary clothes. What was unusual about them was that they were carrying placards and signs. "Register all warlocks," Downworlders must be controlled, praise the cold peace, approve the registry. Among them was a stolid, brown-haired man with a bland sort of face, the kind of face where you could never really remember the features later. He winked at Zara. "My father," she said proudly. "The registry was his idea."
"What interesting signs," said Mark.
"How wonderful to see people expressing their political views," said Zara. "Of course, the Cold Peace has truly created a generation of revolutionaries."
"It is unusual," said Christina, "for a revolution to call for fewer rights for people, not more."
For a moment, Zara's mask slipped, and Christina saw through the artifice of politeness, the breathy little girl voice and demeanor. There was something cold behind it all, something without warmth or empathy or affection.
"People," she said. "What people?"
Diego took hold of her arm.
"Zara," he said, "let's go sit down."
Mark and Christina watched them go in silence.
"I hope Julian's right," Livy said, staring at the empty dais. "He usually is," Ty said. "Not about everything, but about this sort of thing." Kit sat between the twins, which meant they were talking over him. He wasn't entirely sure how he'd ended up in this position. Not that he minded or even noticed at the moment. He was stunned into near silence, something that never happened, by where he was, in Alicante, the heart of the Shadowhunters' country, gazing at the legendary demon towers. He'd fallen in love with Idris at first sight. He hadn't expected that at all. It was like walking into a fairy tale, and not the sort he'd grown used to at the Shadow Market, where fairies were another kind of monster, the kind he'd seen on TV and in books when he was little, a world of magnificent castles and lush forests. Livy winked at Kit.
"You've got that look on your face." "What look?" "You're impressed by Idris. Admit it, Mr. Nothing impresses me." Kit was going to do no such thing.
"I like the clock," he said, pointing up at it.
"There's a legend about the clock." She wiggled her eyebrows at him. "For a second, when it chimes the hour, the gates of heaven open." Livy sighed. A rare wistfulness flashed across her face. "As far as I'm concerned, heaven is just the Institute being ours again, and all of us going home." That surprised Kit. He'd been thinking of this trip to Idris as the end of their chaotic adventure. They'd returned to Los Angeles and he'd start his training. But Livy was right. Things weren't that assured. He glanced over at Zara and her immediate circle, bristling with their ugly signs. "There's still the Black Volume, too," said Ty. He looked formal and neat-haired in a way he didn't usually. Kit was used to him being casual in his hoodies and jeans, and handsome, older-looking Ty left him a bit tongue-tied. "The Queen still wants it."
"Annabelle will give it to Jules. I believe in his ability to charm anything out of anyone," Livy said.
"Or trick anything out of anyone. But yeah, I wish they didn't have to actually meet with the Queen afterwards. I don't like the sound of her."
"I think there's a saying about this," said Kit. "Something about bridges and crossing them when you get there."
Ty had gone rigid, like a hunting dog spotting a fox. "Livy?" His sister followed his gaze, and so did Kit. Coming toward them through the crowd was Diana, a smile breaking across her face, her koi fish tattoo shimmering across one dark cheekbone. With her were two young women in their early 20s. One resembled Gia Penhallow more than a little. She also had dark hair and a decided chin. The other looked incredibly like Mark Blackthorne, down to the curling, pale blonde hair and pointed ears. They were both bundled in unseasonably warm clothes, as if they'd come from a cold climate. Kit realized who they were before Livy's face lit up like the sun.
"Helen!"
she screamed and bolted into her sister's arms. The clock in the council hall was chiming through the guard, signaling that all Nephilim were to gather for the meeting. Robert Lightwood had insisted on leading Julian from his office to the room where Magnus, Kieran, and Annabelle were waiting. Unfortunately for Emma, that meant she was stuck with Manuel as her escort to the council hall. Emma wished she could have a moment alone with Julian, but that wasn't going to happen.
They exchanged a wry look before going their separate ways.
"Looking forward to the meeting?"
Manuel asked. He had his hands in his pockets. His dirty blonde hair was artfully tousled. Emma was surprised he wasn't whistling.
"No one looks forward to meetings," said Emma. "They're a necessary evil."
"Oh, I wouldn't say no one," said Manuel. "Zara loves meetings."
"She seems in favor of all forms of torture," Emma muttered.
Manuel spun around, walking backward down the corridor. They were in one of the larger hallways that had been built after the guard burned in the Dark War.
"Have you ever thought about becoming a Centaurian?" he said.
Emma shook her head.
"They don't let you have a parabatai."
"I always figured that was kind of a pity thing, you and Julian Blackthorne," said Manuel. "I mean, look at you. You're hot, you're skilled, you're a Carstairs. Julian spends all of his time with little kids. He's an old man at 17. Emma wondered what would happen if she threw Manuel through a window. Probably it would delay the meeting.
"I'm just saying, even if you don't want to go to the Scholomance, the cohort could use someone like you. We're the future. You'll see."
His eyes glittered. For a moment they weren't amused or joking. It was the glitter of real fanaticism, and it made Emma feel hollow inside. They had reached the doors of the council hall. There was no one in view. Emma kicked her leg out and swept Manuel's feet out from under him. He went over in a blur and hit the ground. He pushed up instantly on his elbows, looking furious. She doubted she'd hurt him, except maybe where his dignity was located, which had been the point.
"I appreciate your offer," she said. "But if joining the cohort means I'd have to spend my life stuck halfway up a mountain with a bunch of fascists, I'll take living in the past."
She heard him hiss something not very nice in Spanish as she stepped over him and walked into the hall. She reminded herself to ask Christina for a translation when she got a chance.
"You don't need to be here, Julian," said Gia firmly. They were in a massive room whose picture window gave out onto views of Rosalind Forest. It was a surprisingly fancy room. Julian had always thought of the guard as a place of dark stone and heavy wood. This room had brocade wallpaper and gilt furniture upholstered in velvet. Annabelle sat in a wing-backed armchair, looking ill at ease. Magnus was leaning against a wall, seemingly bored. He looked exhausted, too. The shadows under his eyes were nearly black. And Kieran stood by the picture window, his attention fixed on the sky and the trees outside.
"I would like him to be with me," said Annabelle. "He is the reason I came."
"We all appreciate you're here, Annabelle," said Gia.
"And we appreciate that you had past bad experiences with the Clave."
She sounded calm. Julian wondered if she'd have sounded so calm if she'd seen Annabelle rise from the dead, covered in blood, and stab Malcolm through the heart. Kieran turned away from the window.
"We know Julian Blackthorne," he said to Gia. He sounded more human to Julian than he had when they first met, as if his fairy accent was fading.
"We don't know you."
"By which you mean you and Annabelle?" Gia said. Kieran made an expressive fairy gesture that seemed to encompass the room in general.
"I am here because I am the messenger of the Queen," he said. "Annabelle Blackthorne is here for her own reasons, and Magnus is here as he puts up with all of you because of Alec. But do not think that makes it a good idea for you to order us around."
"Annabelle is a shadow hunter," Robert began.
"And I am a prince of fairy," said Kieran. "Son of the king, prince of the frost court, keeper of the cold way, wild hunter, and sword of the host. Do not annoy me." Magnus cleared his throat.
"He has a point."
"About Alec?" said Robert, raising an eyebrow.
"More generally," said Magnus. "Kieran is a downworlder. Annabelle suffered a fate worse than death at the Clave's hands because she cared for downworlders. Out there in the council hall is the cohort. Today is their grab for power. Preventing them from taking it is more important than rules about where Julian should or shouldn't be standing."
Gia looked at Magnus for a moment.
"And you?" she said, surprisingly gently. "You're a downworlder, Bane."
Magnus gave a slow, tired shrug.
"Oh," he said, "me, I'm..."
The glass he was holding slipped out of his hand.
It hit the floor and broke, and a moment later Magnus followed it. He seemed to fold up like paper, his head striking the stone with an ugly thump. Julian lunged forward, but Robert was already grabbing him by the arm. "Go to the council hall," he said. Gia was kneeling next to Magnus, her hand on his shoulder. "Get Alec." He turned Julian free, and Julian ran. Emma fought her way through the council hall in a state of numb horror. Any pleasure she'd felt over knocking Manuel on his butt had dissolved. The whole room seemed to be a whirlwind of ugly shouting and waving signs. "Make the clave pure," and "werewolf containment is the answer," and "keep downworlders controlled." She pushed past a knot of people, Zara at the center, heard someone saying, "Can't believe you had to kill that monster Malcolm Fade yourself after the clave failed." There was a chorus of agreement. "Shows what comes of letting warlocks do what they like," said someone else. "They're too powerful. It doesn't make practical sense." Most of the faces in the room were unfamiliar to Emma. She should have known more of them, she thought, but the Blackthorns had lived a life of isolation in their way, rarely leaving the L.A. Institute. Among the cluster of unfamiliar faces, she caught sight of Diana, tall and regal as always. She was striding through the crowd, and hurrying along in her wake were two familiar figures, Aline and Helen, both of them pink-cheeked, wrapped in massive coats and shawls. They must have arrived from Wrangell Island. Now Emma could see the rest of the Blackthorns. Livy, Ty, and Drew were spilling out of their seats, running to Helen, who bent down to open her arms and gather them all in, hugging them tightly. Helen was brushing back Drew's hair, hugging the twins, tears sliding down her face. Mark was there too, striding toward his sister, and Emma watched with a smile as they threw their arms around each other. In a way it hurt. She would never have that with her parents, never hug them or squeeze their hands again. But it was a good sort of pain. Mark lifted his sister off her feet, and Aline watched, smiling as the two embraced. "Manuel Villalobos is limping," said Christina. She had come up behind Emma and wrapped her arms around her from behind, resting her chin on her friend's shoulder. "Did you do that?" "I might have," Emma murmured. She heard Christina giggle. "He was trying to talk me into joining the cohort." She turned around and squeezed Christina's hand. "We're going to take them down. They won't win, right?" She glanced at Christina's pendant. "Tell me the angel is on our side." Christina shook her head. "I am worried," she said. "Worried for Mark, for Helen, and for Kieran." "Kieran's a witness for the clave. The cohort can't touch him. He's a prince of faerie, everything they hate. And I do not think I realized until we arrived here how much they hate. They will not want him to speak, and they will absolutely not want the council to listen." "That's why we're here to make them listen," Emma began, but Christina was looking past her, a startled expression on her face. Emma turned to see Diego, miraculously without Zara, beckoning Christina from an empty row of seats. "I must go and talk to him," Christina said. She squeezed Emma's shoulder, looking suddenly hopeful. Emma wished her luck, and Christina disappeared into the crowd, leaving Emma looking around for Julian. She didn't see her parabatai anywhere, but what she did see was a tight group of shadow hunters, Mark among them, and a sudden silver flash of weapons. Samantha Larkspear had pulled a wicked-looking blade. Emma headed toward the raised voices, her hand already reaching for Cortana's hilt. Mark loved all his brothers and sisters, none more than the others. Still, Helen was special. She was like him, half-fairy, drawn to its temptations. Helen even claimed she could remember their mother, Nerissa, though Mark couldn't. He set Helen down on her feet, ruffling her pale hair. Her face. She looked different, older. Not in lines around her eyes or coarsening skin, just in a certain cast of her features. He wondered if she had named the stars through the years as he did. Julian, Tiberius, Livia, Drusilla, Octavian. And she would have added another that he never had. Mark. "I would speak to you," he said, "of Neen, our mother's sister."
An echo of fairy formality was in her voice when she replied. Diana told me you met her in Fairy. I knew of her, but not of where she could be found. We should speak of her and of other matters as pressing. She looked up at him and sighed, touching her hand to his cheek. Such as when you got so tall. I think it happened when I was in the hunt. Should I apologize? Not at all. I was worried. She stepped back to look at him quizzically. I think I may owe Kieran Kingson some thanks for his care of you. As I owe Aileen for her care of you. Helen smiled at that. She is the light of my days. She glanced up at the large clock over the dais. We have little time now, Mark. If all goes as we hope, we will have forever to confer with one another. But either way, Aileen and I will remain this night in Alicante, and from what Gia says, so will you. It will give us a chance to talk. That depends on how tonight goes, doesn't it? A sharp voice interrupted them. It was Samantha Larkspear. Mark vaguely remembered that she had a brother who looked a great deal like her. She wore Centaurian gear and carried a placard that said, "The only good fairy is a dead fairy." There was a blob of what looked like black paint at the bottom of the sign. "Pithy," Mark said, but Helen had paled with shock, staring at the words on the placard. "After this afternoon's vote, if scum like you are allowed in Alicante, I'd be very surprised," Samantha said. "Enjoy it while you can." "You're talking to the wife of the consul's daughter," said Aileen, her nostrils flaring. "Watch your mouth, Samantha Larkspear." Samantha made an odd, gulping, hissing noise and reached for her weapons belt, flashing a dagger with a thick knuckle guard hilt. Mark could see her brother, pale and black-haired as she was, pushing toward them through the crowd. Helen had her hand on the serif blade in her belt. Moving instinctively, Mark reached for the blade at his own hip, tensed for violence. Kit looked up when Julian's hand fell on his shoulder. He'd been slouching in his chair, mostly looking at Alicante through the big glass window behind the wooden, stage-like thing at the front of the room. He'd been deliberately not looking at Livy and Ty, greeting their sister. Something about the tight knot of blackthorns hugging and exclaiming over each other reminded him exactly of how much he wasn't one of them, in a way he hadn't been reminded since Los Angeles. "Your sister's here," he said to Julian. He pointed. "Helen." Julian glanced over at his siblings briefly. Kit had the feeling he already knew. He looked tense and sparking at the edges, like a snapped electrical wire. "I need you to do something," he said. "Alex guarding the east doors to the hall. Go find him and bring him to Magnus. Tell him Magnus is in the consul's guest quarters. He'll know where that is." Kit swung his legs off the chair in front of him. "Why?" "Just trust me." Julian stood up. "Make it look like it's your idea. Like you need Alec to show you something or help you find someone. I don't want anyone's curiosity stirred up." "You're not really thinking of fighting in the middle of the council hall, are you?" said Emma. "I mean, considering that it would be illegal and all that." She clicked her tongue against her teeth. "Not a good idea, Samantha. Put that dagger away." The small group, Helen, Aileen, Mark, and Samantha, turned to stare at Emma as if she'd appeared in a puff of smoke. They'd all been too angry to notice her approach. The gold clock overhead began to chime urgently. The crowd started to unknot itself, shadow hunters searching for empty seats in the rows facing the dais. Dane Larkspear, who'd been coming toward his sister, had halted in the middle of the aisle. Emma saw to her surprise that Manuel was blocking his way. Maybe Manuel didn't think a Centaurian brawling on the floor of the council hall would be a great idea either. Zara was looking over too, her red mouth set in an angry line. "You don't get to pull rank on me, Aileen Penhallow," said Samantha, but she shoved her dagger back into its sheath. "Not when you're married to that thing." "Did you draw that?" Emma interrupted, pointing at the blobby sketch on Samantha's placard. "Is that supposed to be a dead fairy?" She was pretty sure it was. The sketch had arms and legs and dragonfly wings, sort of. "Impressive," said Emma. "You've got talent, Samantha, real talent." Samantha looked surprised. "You think so?"
God, no, said Emma. Now go sit down. Zara's waving at you.
Samantha hesitated and then turned away. Emma grabbed hold of Helen's hand. They started to walk toward the long bench where the Blackthorns were seated. Her heart was thumping. Not that Samantha was much danger, but if they'd started something and the rest of Zara's friends had joined in, it could have been a real fight. Aline and Mark were on either side of them. Helen's fingers curled around Emma's arm.
I remember this, she said in a low voice.
Her fingertips brushed the scar that Cortana had made years ago, when Emma had clutched the blade to her body after her parents' death. It was Helen who had been there when Emma woke up in a world where her parents were gone forever, though it was Julian who had placed the sword in Emma's arms. But now Cortana was strapped on her back. Now was their chance to right the wrongs of the past, the wrongs done to Helen and Mark and those like them by the Clave, the wrong the Clave had done to the Carstairs in ignoring their deaths. It made the knowledge that she would soon be exiled hurt even more, the thought that she would not be with the Blackthorns when they were reunited. They sped up as they got close to the other Blackthorns, and there was Julian, standing among his siblings. His eyes met Emma's. She could see even across the distance between them that his had turned nearly black. She knew without having to ask. Something was very wrong. Alec Lightwood was very hard to keep up with. He was older than Kit, and he had longer legs, and he'd taken off, flat out running the moment Kit had told him that Magnus needed him. Kit wasn't sure their cover story that he wanted Alec to show him around the guard was going to hold up if anyone stopped them. But no one did. The loud chiming was still sounding, and everyone was hurrying toward the main council hall. When they burst into the high-ceilinged consul's quarters, they found Magnus lying on a long sofa. Kieran and Annabelle were at opposite ends of the room, staring like cats just introduced to a new environment. Gia and Robert stood by the sofa. Alec started toward it, and his father moved to put a hand on his shoulder. Alec stopped where he was, his whole body tense. Let me go, he said. He's fine, said Robert. Brother Enoch was just here. His magic's depleted and he's weak, but... I know what's wrong with him, Alec said, pushing past the Inquisitor. Robert watched his son as Alec knelt down by the side of the long couch. He brushed Magnus's hair back from his forehead, and the warlock stirred and murmured. He hasn't been well for a while, said Alec, half to himself. His magic gets depleted so fast. I told him to go to the Spiral Labyrinth, but there hasn't been time. Kit stared. He'd heard of Magnus even before he'd met him, of course. Magnus was famous in Downworld. And when he had met Magnus, the warlock had been so full of kinetic energy, a whirl of dry wit and blue fire. It hadn't even occurred to him that Magnus might get sick or tired. Is there any way to make him feel better? Said Annabelle. She was vibrating with tension, her hands working at her sides. He noticed for the first time that she was missing a finger on her right hand. He hadn't looked at her too closely before. She gave him the creeps. I need him. Admirably, Alec didn't lose his temper. He needs rest, he said. We could delay the meeting. Alec, we can't, Gia spoke gently. Obviously Magnus should rest. Annabelle, you'll be taken care of, I promise.
No,
Annabelle shrunk back against the wall.
I want Magnus with me, or Julian. Get Julian. What's going on?
Kit recognized her voice even before he turned to see Zara in the doorway. Her lipstick looked like a harsh slash of blood against her pale skin. She was looking at Magnus, the corner of her mouth twisted in a smirk.
Consul, she said and bowed to Gia. Everyone is assembled. Should I tell them the meeting will be delayed?
No, Miss Dearborn, said Gia, smoothing down her embroidered robe. Thank you, but we don't need you to handle this for us. The assembly will go as planned.
Dearborn, Annabelle echoed.
Her gaze was fixed on Zara. Her eyes had gone flat and glittering like a snake's.
You're a Dearborn.
Zara looked merely puzzled, as if wondering who Annabelle might be.
Zara is quite an advocate for restricting the rights of downworlders, Chia said neutrally. We're interested in safety, Zara said, clearly stung. That's all.
We had better go, said Robert Lightwood. He was still looking at Alec, but Alec wasn't looking at him. He was sitting by Magnus, his hand against Magnus's cheek. Alec, if you need me, send for me. I'll send Kit, Alec said without looking around. I'll return for you, Robert said to Kieran, who had remained silently by the window, barely a shadow in the room's shadows. Kieran nodded. Robert squeezed Alec's shoulder briefly. Gia extended a hand to Annabelle, and after a moment of staring at Zara, Annabelle followed the consul and the Inquisitor from the room.
Is he sick? Zara said, looking at Magnus with a distant interest. I didn't think warlocks got sick.
Wouldn't it be funny if he died before you? I mean, what with him being immortal, he must have thought it would go the other way.
Alec raised his head slowly.
What?
Well, I mean, since Magnus is immortal and you, you know, aren't, she clarified.
He's immortal? Alec's voice was colder than Kit had ever heard it.
I wish you'd told me that before. I would have turned back time and found myself a nice mortal husband to grow old with.
Well, wouldn't that be better? Zara said. Then you could get old and die at the same time.
At the same time, Alec echoed. He had barely moved or raised his voice, but his rage seemed to fill the room. Even Zara was starting to look uneasy.
How would you suggest we arrange that? Jump off a cliff together when one of us started feeling sickly?
Maybe, Zara looked sulky. You have to agree the situation you're in is a tragedy.
Alec rose to his feet, and in that moment was the famous Alec Lightwood Kit had heard about, the hero of past battles, the archer boy with a deadly aim.
This is what I want and what I've chosen, he said. How dare you tell me it's a tragedy?
Magnus never pretended. He never tried to fool me into thinking it would be easy. But choosing Magnus is one of the easiest things I've ever done. We all have a lifetime, Zara, and none of us know how long or short it might be. Surely even you know that.
I expect you mean to be rude and cruel, but I doubt you meant to sound stupid as well. She flushed.
But if you die of old age and he lives forever,
then he'll be there for Max, and that makes both of us happy, said Alec.
And I will be a uniquely lucky person, because there will be someone who always remembers me, who will always love me. Magnus won't always mourn, but until the end of time he will remember me and love me.
What makes you so sure? Said Zara, but there was an edge of uncertainty in her voice.
Because he's 3,000 times the human being you'll ever be, said Alec.
Now, get out of here, before I risk his life by waking him up so he can turn you into a garbage fire, something that would match your personality.
Oh, said Zara, so rude.
Kit thought it was more than rude. He thought Alec meant it. He kind of hoped Zara would stick around to test the theory. Instead, she stalked toward the door and paused there, glancing back at them with dislike.
Come on, Alec, she said. The truth is that shadow hunters and downworlders aren't meant to be together. You and Bane are a disgrace. But you can't just be content with the Clave letting you pervert your angelic lineage. No, you have to force it on the rest of us.
Really? Said Kieran, who Kit had nearly forgotten was there. You all have to sleep with Magnus Bane.
How exciting for you.
Shut up, fairy dirt, said Zara.
You'll learn. You've picked the wrong side. You and those Blackthorns and Jace Herondale, that ginger bitch Clary.
She was breathing hard, her face flushed.
I'll enjoy watching you all go down, she said, and flounced from the room.
Did she really say, pervert your angelic lineage? Said Alec, looking stupefied.
Fairy dirt, mused Kieran. That is, as Mark would say, a new one.
Unbelievable. Alec sat down next to the sofa again, drawing up his knees.
Nothing she said surprised me, said Kieran. That is how they are.
That is how the cold pieces made them, afraid of what is new and different and filled with hatred like ice. She may seem ridiculous, Zara Dearborn, but do not make the mistake of underestimating her and the cohort. He looked down at the window. Hate like that can tear down the world.
This is a very strange request, said Diego. You're the one with the fake relationship, said Christina. I'm sure you've been asked for stranger things.
Diego laughed, not with much humor. They were sitting a row away from the Blackthorns in the council hall. The clock had stopped chiming to announce the meeting's beginning, and the room was full, though the dais was still empty.
I'm glad Jaime told you, he said, selfishly. I could bear that you hated me, but not that you despised me.
Christina sighed.
I'm not sure I could ever really despise you, she said. I should have told you more, he said. I wanted to keep you safe, and I denied myself that the cohort and their plans were your problem. I didn't know they had designs on the Los Angeles Institute until it was too late, and I was mistaken in Manuel, as much as anyone. I trusted him. I know, Christina said. It is not that I blame you for anything. For such a long time, we were Christina and Diego, a pair, together. And when that was over, I felt half myself. When you came back, I thought we could be as we were before, and I tried, but you don't love me like that anymore, he finished. She paused for a moment. No, she said. I don't. Not like that. It was like trying to return to a place in your childhood you remember as perfect. It will always have changed, because you have changed.
Diego's Adam's apple moved as he swallowed. I can't blame you. I don't like myself much right now.
Maybe this could help you like yourself a little more. It would be a great kindness, Diego.
He shook his head.
Trust you, I suppose, to take pity on a lost fairy. It isn't pity, said Christina.
She glanced back over her shoulder. Zara had left the room some moments earlier and hadn't returned yet. Samantha was glaring at her, though, apparently in the belief that Christina was trying to steal Zara's fiancé.
They frighten me. They will kill him after he testifies.
The cohort is frightening, said Diego. But the cohort is not the Centaurians, and not all Centaurians are like Zara. Rayan, Divya, Jen are good people. Like the Clave, it is an organization that has a cancer at its heart. Some of the body is sick and some healthy. Our mission is to discover a way to kill the sickness without killing off the body. The doors of the council hall opened. The consul, Gia Penhallow, entered, her silver-flecked dark robes sweeping around her. The room, which had been full of lively chatter, sank to hushed murmurs. Christina sat back as the consul began to climb the stairs to the dais.
Thank you all for coming on such short notice, Nephilim.
The consul stood in front of a low wooden podium, its base decorated with a sigil of four C's. There was gray in her black hair now that Emma didn't remember seeing before, wrinkles at the corners of her eyes. It couldn't be easy, being the consul during a time of unspoken war.
Most of you know about Malcolm Fade. He was one of our closest allies, or so we thought. He betrayed us some weeks ago, and even now we are still learning of the bloody and terrible crimes he committed.
The murmur that went around the room sounded to Emma like a rush of the tide. She wished Julian was next to her, so she could bump his shoulder with hers or squeeze his hand, but mindful of the Inquisitor's instruction, they had sat at the opposite end of the long bench after he told her Magnus had collapsed.
I promised Annabelle Magnus would be with her, he'd said in a low voice, not wanting the younger Blackthorns to hear and be panicked. I gave my word.
You couldn't have guessed. Poor Magnus. There was no way to know he was sick. But she remembered herself saying, "Don't promise what you can't deliver," and she felt cold all over.
There is a longer story to Fade's betrayal, one you might not know, Gia said. In 1812, he fell in love with a shadow hunter girl, Annabelle Blackthorne. Her family deplored the idea of her marrying a warlock,
In the end, she was murdered by other Nephilim. Malcolm was told she had become an Iron Sister.
Why didn't they kill him too?
Called someone from the crowd. He was a powerful warlock, a valuable asset, said Gia. In the end, it was decided to leave him alone. But when he discovered what had actually happened to Annabelle, he lost his mind. This past century, he has been seeking revenge against shadow hunters.
My lady.
It was Zara, upright and very prim. She had just come through the hall doors and was standing in the aisle.
You tell us this story as if you mean for us to have sympathy for the girl and the warlock. But Malcolm Fade was a monster, a murderer. Some girl's infatuation with him doesn't excuse what he did.
I find, said Gia, that there is a difference between an excuse and an explanation.
Then why are we being treated to this explanation? The warlock is dead. I hope this is not some attempt to wring reparations out of the council. No one associated with that monster deserves any recompense for his death.
Gia's look was like the edge of a blade.
I understand you've been very active in council affairs lately, Zara, she said. That does not mean you can interrupt the consul. Go sit down.
After a moment, Zara sat, looking angry. Aline pumped her fist. Go, Mom, she whispered. However, someone else had risen up to take Zara's place. Her father.
Consul, he said. We're not ignorant. We were told this meeting would involve significant testimony by a witness that would impact the clave. Isn't it about time you brought that witness out? If indeed they exist.
Oh, she exists, Gia said. It is Annabelle. Annabelle Blackthorne.
Now the murmur that went through the room sounded like the crash of a wave. A moment later, Robert Lightwood appeared, wearing a grim expression. Behind him came two guards, and between them walked Annabelle. Annabelle seemed quite small as she came up on the dais beside the Inquisitor. The black volume was hanging from a strap over her back, which made her look even younger, like a girl on her way to school. A hiss went through the room. Undead, Emma heard, and unclean. Annabelle shrunk back against Robert.
This is an outrage, sputtered Zara's father. Did we not all suffer enough from the corrosive filth of the Indarkand? Must you bring this thing in front of us?
Julian sprang to his feet.
The Indarkand were not undead, he said, turning to face the hall. They were turned by the infernal cup. Annabelle is exactly who she was in life. She was tortured by Malcolm, kept in a half-alive state for years. She wants to help us.
Julian Blackthorne, sneered Dearborn. My daughter told me about you. Your uncle was mad. Your whole family's mad. Only a madman could find this a good idea.
Do not, said Annabelle, and her voice rang out clear and strong. Speak that way to him. He is my blood kin.
Blackthorns, said Dearborn. Seems they're all mad, dead, or both.
If he'd expected a laugh, he didn't get one. The room was silent.
Sit, the consul said to Dearborn coldly. It appears your family has an issue with the way Nephilim are meant to comport themselves. Interrupt me again, and you'll be thrown out of the hall.
Dearborn sat, but his eyes gleamed with rage. He wasn't the only one. Emma scanned the room quickly and saw clusters of hateful glares directed at the dais. She choked back her nerves. Julian had pushed his way into the aisle and was standing facing the front of the room. Annabelle, he said, his voice low and encouraging. Tell them about the king.
The Unseelie King, Annabelle said softly. The Lord of Shadows. He was in league with Malcolm. It is important you all know this, because even now, he plans the destruction of all shadow hunters.
But the fair folk are weak.
A man in an embroidered gondola was on his feet, dark eyes sparkling with concern. Christina murmured into Emma's ear that he was the head of the Marrakesh Institute.
Years of the Cold Peace have weakened them. The king cannot hope to stand against us.
Not in a clash of equal armies, no, Annabelle said in her small voice.
but the king has harnessed the power of the Black Volume, and he has learned how to destroy the power of the Nephilim, how to cancel out their runes, seraph blades, and witchlight. You'd be fighting his forces with no more power than mundanes.
This absolutely cannot be true.
It was a thin, dark-haired man Emma remembered from the long-ago discussion of the cold piece, Laszlo Balak, head of the Budapest Institute.
She is lying. She has no reason to lie. Diana was on her feet now, too, her shoulders set back in a fighting stance. Laszlo, of all the people, Miss Rayburn,
the Hungarian man's expression hardened.
I think we all know you should recuse yourself from the discussion.
Diana froze.
You fraternize with fairies, he went on, smacking his lips as he spoke. You've been observed.
Oh, by the angel, Laszlo, said the consul. Diana has nothing to do with this, other than having the bad fortune to disagree with you.
Laszlo's right, said Horace Dearborn. The Blackthorns are fairy sympathizers, betrayers of the law.
But we're not liars, said Julian. His voice was steel, edged in ice. Dearborn took the bait.
What's that supposed to mean?
Your daughter didn't kill Malcolm Fade, said Julian. Annabelle did. Zara popped to her feet like a puppet jerked upward on strings.
That's a lie,
she shrieked.
It is not a lie, said Annabelle. Malcolm raised me from the dead. He used the blood of Arthur Blackthorne to do it. And for that, and for his torture and abandonment of me, I killed him.
Now the room exploded. Shouts echoed off the walls. Samantha and Dane Larkspear were on their feet, shaking their fists. Horace Dearborn was roaring that Annabelle was a liar, that all Blackthorns were.
Enough, shouted Gia. Silence! La spada mortale.
A small olive-skinned woman rose from a place near the back. She wore a plain dress, but her thick necklace sparkled with jewels. Her hair was a deep gray, worn nearly to her hips, and her voice carried enough authority to cut through the noise in the room.
What did you say, Chiara? Gia demanded.
Emma knew her name. Chiara Malatesta, head of the Rome Institute in Italy.
The mortal sword, said Chiara. If there is a question of whether this person, if that's what she can be called, is telling the truth, ply her with Malaturk. Then we can dispense with pointless arguments about whether she's lying.
No.
Annabelle's eyes darted around the room in a panic.
Not the sword.
See, she's lying, said Dame Larkspear. She fears the sword will reveal the truth.
She fears the sword because she was tortured by the council, Julian said. He started toward the dais, but two of the council guards seized him, holding him back. Emma started to rise, but Helen pressed her firmly back into her seat.
Not yet, Helen whispered. It will make things worse. She has to at least try.
But Emma's heart was racing. Julian was still being restrained from approaching the dais. Every nerve in her body was shrieking as Robert Lightwood moved away and returned, carrying something long and sharp and silver. Something that gleamed like dark water. She felt Julian inhale sharply. He had held the mortal sword himself before and knew the pain it caused.
Don't do this,
he said, but his voice was drowned in the swell of other voices. A clamor in the room as various shadow hunters rose to their feet, craning for a glimpse of what was going on.
She's a filthy, undead creature, Zara shouted. She should be put out of her misery, not standing up in front of the council.
Annabelle blanched. Emma could feel Julian's tension, knew what he was thinking. If Magnus were here, Magnus could explain. Annabelle was not a revenant. She had been brought back to life. She was a living shadow hunter. Magnus was a downworlder that the Clave trusted, one of a few. None of this would be happening if he'd been able to join the meeting.
Magnus, Emma thought. Oh, Magnus, I hope you're all right. I wish you could be with us.
The sword will determine Annabelle's fitness to give testimony, Gia said in a hard voice that carried to the back of the room. That is the law. Stand back and let the mortal sword work.
The crowd fell silent. The mortal instruments were the highest power the shadow hunters knew, outside the angel himself. Even Zara closed her mouth. "Take your time," Robert said to Annabelle. The compassion in his face surprised Emma. She remembered him forcing the blade into Julian's hands, and Julian had been only 12. She had been angry with Robert for a long time after that, though Julian didn't appear to bear a grudge. Annabelle was panting like a frightened rabbit. She looked at Julian, who gave her an encouraging nod, and reached her hands out slowly. When she took the sword, a shudder went through her body, as if she'd touched an electric fence. Her face tensed, but she held the sword unharmed. Gia exhaled with visible relief. The sword had proved it. Annabelle was a shadow hunter. The hall remained silent, as everyone stared. Both the consul and the inquisitor stepped back, giving Annabelle space. She stood in the center of the dais, a lonely figure in an ill-fitting dress. "What is your name?" Robert asked her, his tone deceptively mild.
"Annabelle Callisto Blackthorne," she spoke between quick breaths.
"And who are you standing on this dais with?" Her blue-green eyes darted desperately between them.
"I don't know you," she breathed. "You are consul and inquisitor, but not the ones I knew. You are clearly a Lightwood, but—"
She shook her head before her face brightened.
"Robert," she said. "Julian called you Robert."
Samantha Larkspear laughed derisively, and several other placard bearers joined her.
"There isn't enough left in her brain to give decent evidence."
"Be silent," thundered Gia. "Miss Blackthorne, you knew. You were the lover of Malcolm Fade, High Warlock of Los Angeles."
"He was only a warlock when I knew him, of no rank," Annabelle's voice shook. "Please, ask me if I killed him. I can't stand much more of this."
"What we discuss here is not your choice." Gia didn't seem angry, but Annabelle visibly flinched.
"This is a mistake," Livy whispered to Emma. "They need to just ask her about Malcolm and end this. They can't make this into an interrogation."
"It'll be fine," Emma said. "It will." But her heart was racing. The other Blackthorns were watching with visible tension. On her other side, Emma could see Helen gripping the arms of her seat. Aline was rubbing her shoulder. "Ask her," Julian said. "Just ask her, Gia."
"Julian, enough,"
Gia said, but she turned to Annabelle, her dark eyes expectant. "Annabelle Callisto Blackthorne, did you kill Malcolm Fade?"
"Yes."
Hate crystallized Annabelle's voice, strengthening it.
"I cut him open. I watched him bleed to death. Zara Dearborn did nothing. She has been lying to you all."
A gasp ran around the room. For a moment, Julian relaxed, and the guards who'd been holding him released their grip. Zara, red-faced, gaped from the crowd.
"Thank the angel," Emma thought. "They'll have to listen now."
Annabelle faced the room, a sword in her hand, and for that moment, Emma could see what Malcolm must have fallen in love with. She looked proud, delighted, beautiful. Something sailed past her head and smashed into the lectern. A bottle, Emma thought. Glass shattered outward from it. There was a gasp and then a giggle, and then other objects began flying through the air. The crowd seemed to be flinging whatever they had in hand. Not the whole crowd, Emma realized. It was the cohort and their supporters. There weren't that many of them, but there were enough, and their hate was bigger than the whole room. Emma met Julian's eyes. She saw the despair in his. They had expected better. Even after everything they'd been through, they'd expected better, somehow. It was true that many shadow hunters were now on their feet shouting at the cohort to stop, but Annabelle had crumpled to her knees, her head down, her hands still gripping the sword. She hadn't raised her hands to shield herself from the objects flying at her. They'd smacked into the floor and the lectern in the window. Bottles and bags, coins and stones, even watches and bracelets.
"Stop!"
Julian shouted, and the cold rage with which he spoke was enough to shock at least a few into silence.
"By the angel, this is the truth. She is telling you the truth about Malcolm, About the Unseelie King? How are we supposed to know that? Hissed Dearborn. Who says the mortal sword works on that thing? She is tainted. She is a monster, shouted Zara. This is a conspiracy to drag us into war with the Unseelie Court. The Blackthorns care about nothing but their lies and their filthy fairy siblings.
Julian,
Annabelle gasped. The mortal sword held so tightly in her hands that blood began to bloom on her skin where she gripped the blade.
Julian, help me. Magnus, where's Magnus?
Julian struggled against the guard's hold. Robert hurried forward, his big hands outstretched. Enough, he said. Come with me, Annabelle.
Leave me alone!
With a hoarse shout, Annabelle flinched back from him, raising the blade in her hand. Emma was reminded suddenly and coldly of two things. The mortal sword was not just an instrument of justice. It was a weapon. And Annabelle was a shadow hunter with a weapon in her hand. As if he couldn't believe what was happening, Robert took another step toward Annabelle, reaching out for her, as if he could calm her, convince her. He opened his mouth to speak, and she thrust the blade up between them. It pierced through Robert Lightwood's robes and sliced into his chest. Kit felt like someone who'd wandered into another family's hospital room by mistake and wasn't allowed to leave. Alec sat by Magnus's side, occasionally touching his shoulder or saying something in a low voice. Kieran stared out the window as if he could transport himself through the glass.
Should someone tell the kids? Max and Rafe? Kit said finally.
Alec stood up and crossed the room, where a carafe of water rested on a side table. He poured himself a glass.
Not right now, he said. They're safe in the city with my mother. They don't need... Magnus doesn't need...
He took a drink of water.
I was hoping he'd get better and we wouldn't have to tell them anything.
You said you knew what was wrong with him, said Kit. Is it dangerous?
I don't know, Alec said. But I do know one thing. It isn't just him. It's other warlocks, too. Tessa and Jem have been looking for a cause or cure, but she's sick, too.
He broke off. A dull roar was audible, a sound like waves rising, about to crash. Alec blanched.
I've heard that sound before, he said. Something's happening.
In the hall. Kieran was off the windowsill in a fluid single motion.
It is death.
It might not be, said Kit, straining his ears. I can smell blood, Kieran said, and hear screams. He climbed up on the windowsill and jerked down one of the curtains. He seized up the curtain rod, which had a sharply pointed finial, and leapt to the floor, brandishing it like a spear. His silver-black eyes gleamed.
I will not be found weaponless when they come. You should stay here, both of you. I'll find out what's going on, Alec said.
My father. The door flew open. Kieran flung his curtain rod. Diego, who had just appeared in the doorway, ducked as it flew by and slammed into the wall, where it jammed point first.
Gachingados, said Diego, looking stunned. What the hell?
He thinks you're here to kill us, said Kit.
Are you?
Diego rolled his eyes.
Things have gone bad in the hall, he said.
Has anyone been injured? Alec asked. Diego hesitated.
Your father, he began.
Alec set his glass down and walked across the room to Magnus. He bent and kissed him on the forehead and the cheek. Magnus didn't move, only slept on peacefully, his cat eyes closed. Kit envied him.
Stay here, Alec said to Kit and Kieran. Then he turned and walked out of the room.
Diego looked after him grimly. Kit felt a little sick. He had a feeling that whatever had happened to Alec's father, it hadn't been minor.
Kieran yanked his curtain rod out of the wall and pointed it at Diego. You have delivered your message, he said. Now go. I will protect the boy and the warlock.
Diego shook his head.
I'm here to get you, he pointed at Kieran, and take you to the Scholomance.
I will not go anywhere with you, said Kieran. You have no morality. You brought dishonor upon Lady Christina.
You have no idea what happened between me and Christina, added Diego in a frozen voice.
Kit noticed that perfect Diego was looking a little less than perfect. The shadows under his eyes were deep and violet, and his brown skin was sallow. Exhaustion and tension drew his fine features tight.
"Say what you will of fairies," Kieran said. "We have no greater scorn than that we hold toward those who betray a heart given into their keeping."
"It was Christina," said Diego, "who asked me to come here and bring you to the Scholomance. If you refuse, you will be dishonoring her wishes."
Kieran scowled. "You are lying."
"I am not," said Diego.
"She feared for your safety. The cohort's hatred is at a fever pitch, and the hall runs wild. You will be safe if you come with me, but I can promise nothing otherwise."
"How would I be safe at the Scholomance with Zara Dearborn and her friends?"
"She won't be there," said Diego. "She and Samantha and Manuel plan to remain here, in Idris, at the heart of power. Power is all they have ever wanted. The Scholomance is a place of peaceful study." He held his hand out. "Come with me. For Christina."
Kit stared, his breath caught. It was a very strange moment. He had learned enough about shadow hunters now to understand what it meant that Diego was a Centaurian, and what laws he was breaking, offering to smuggle Kieran to the Scholomance. And he understood enough of the pride of the fair folk to know what Kieran was accepting if he agreed. There was another roar of noise outside.
"If you're here," Kit said cautiously, "and the cohort attacks you, Mark and Christina will want to protect you, and they could get hurt doing it."
Kieran set the curtain rod down on the floor. He looked at Kit.
"Tell Mark where I've gone," he said, "and give Christina my thanks."
Kit nodded. Diego inclined his head before stepping forward and taking Kieran awkwardly by the arm. He pressed the fingers of his other hand against the Primi Ordine pin on his gear. Before Kit could speak, Diego and Kieran vanished, a swirl of bright light streaking across the air where they had stood.
The guards surged forward as Gia reached to catch Robert's slumping body. Her face was a mask of horror. Gia sank to her knees, reaching for her steely, carving an Irazi onto Robert's limp, dangling arm. His blood spread out around them both, a sluggishly moving pool of scarlet.
"Annabelle!" Julian's voice was barely a whisper of bone-deep shock. Emma could almost see the abyss of guilt and self-blame opening at his feet.
He began to struggle frantically against the grip of the guards holding him.
"Let me go, let me go!"
"Stay back!" Gia screamed. "All of you, stay back!" She was kneeling beside Robert, her hands wet with his blood as she tried again and again to cut a healing rune into his skin. Two other guards pounded up the steps and halted uncertainly at her words. Annabelle, her blue dress splashed with blood, held the sword in front of her like a barrier. Robert's blood was already sinking into the blade, as if it were porous stone drinking up water. Julian tore free of his restraints and leapt up onto the bloody dais. Emma shot to her feet, Christina seizing the back of her shirt, but to no avail. She was already clambering onto the narrow back of the bench. Thank the angel for all the hours she'd spent practicing on the rafters in the training room, she thought, and ran, leaping from the end of the bench, into the aisle. There were voices shouting at her, to her, a roar like waves. She ignored them. Julian rose slowly to his feet, facing Annabelle.
"Stay away!"
Annabelle shrieked, waving the mortal sword. It seemed to be glowing, pulsing even, in her grip. Or was that Emma's imagination?
"Stay away from me!"
"Annabelle, stop." Julian spoke calmly, his hands up to show they were empty. Empty. Emma fumed. Where was his sword? Where were his weapons? His eyes wide and guileless. "This will only make things worse." Annabelle was sobbing harsh breaths.
"Liar! Get back! Get away from me!"
"I never lied to you."
"You told me they would give me Blackthorn Manor. You told me Magnus would protect me. But look!"
She swept her arm in a wide arc, indicating the whole room.
"I am tainted to them, despised, a criminal."
"You can still come back." Julian's voice was a marvel of steadiness. "Put the sword down."
For a moment, Annabelle seemed to hesitate. Emma was at the foot of the dais steps. She saw Annabelle's grip loosen on the hilt of the sword. Gia stood up. Her robes were wet with Robert's blood, her steely limp in her hand.
"He's dead," she said.
It was like a key turning the lock of a cage, freeing the occupants. The guards lunged up the steps, leaping toward Annabelle, blades outstretched. She spun with inhuman quickness, striking at them, and a sword slashed across both their chests. There were screams as they collapsed, and Emma was running up the stairs, drawing Cortana, leaping in front of Julian. From here, she could see all of the council hall. It was a melee. Some were fleeing through the doors. The Blackthorns and Christina were on their feet, fighting toward the dais, though a line of guards had appeared to hold them back. As Emma watched, Livy ducked under a guard's arm and began to shove her way towards them. A longsword glimmered in her hand. Emma looked back at Annabelle. It was clear this near to her that something had snapped inside her. She looked blank, her eyes dead and disconnected. Her gaze shifted past Emma. Alec had burst through the doors. He stared up at the dais, his face a mask of grief and shock. Emma wrenched her eyes away from him as Annabelle sprang for Julian like a cat, her sword cutting the air before her. Instead of raising Cortana to meet Annabelle's thrust, Emma threw herself to the side, knocking Julian to the polished floor of the dais. For a moment, he was against her. They were together, body to body, and she felt the parabatized strength flow through her. The mortal sword came down again, and they sprang apart, redoubled in strength, as it sliced through the wood at their feet. The room was full of screaming. Emma thought she heard Alec call for Robert.
"Dad? Please, Dad!"
She thought of the tapestry of him in Robert's room. She thought of Isabel. She whirled with Cortana in her hand, and the flat of the blade slammed against Melotok. Both swords shuddered. Annabelle jerked her sword back, her eyes suddenly almost feral. Someone was shouting for Julian. It was Livy, clambering up the side of the dais.
"Livy!"
Julian yelled.
"Livy, get out of here!"
Annabelle swung again, and Emma raised Cortana, cutting on the upstroke, pushing closer, slamming her sword against Annabelle's with all the force in her body, bringing the blades together with a massive, echoing clang. And the mortal sword shattered. It cracked jaggedly along the blade, the top half shearing away. Annabelle shrieked and stumbled backward, and black fluid spilled from the broken sword like sap from a felled tree. Emma collapsed to her knees. It was as if the hand that held Cortana had been struck by lightning. Her wrist was humming, and a ringing sounded all the way up to her bones, making her body shake. She grabbed for Cortana's hilt with her right hand, panicking, desperate not to drop it.
"Emma?"
Julian was holding his own arm stiffly, Emma saw, as if he'd been hurt too. The humming was receding. Emma tried to get to her feet and stumbled. Her teeth bit down into her lip with frustration. How dare her body betray her?
"I'm fine. Fine."
Livy gasped at the sight of the smashed mortal sword. She had reached the top of the dais, Julian reaching out, and Livy tossed him the sword she was holding. He caught it neatly and spun to face Annabelle, who was staring down at the broken weapon in her hand. The consul had seen what had happened too, and was striding toward them.
"It's over, Annabelle," Julian said. He didn't look triumphant, he looked weary.
"It's done."
Annabelle gave a growl low in her throat and lunged. Julian raised its blade, but Annabelle whipped past him, her black hair seeming to soar around her. Her feet left the ground, and for a moment she was truly beautiful, a shadow hunter in full, flowering glory, just before she landed lightly on the wooden floor at the dais's edge and drove her jagged, broken half-blade into Livy's heart. Livy's eyes shot wide. Her mouth formed an "oh," as if she were astonished by discovering something small and surprising, like a mouse on the kitchen counter, an overturned vase of flowers, a broken wristwatch. Nothing huge, nothing terrible. Annabelle stepped back, breathing hard. She no longer looked beautiful. Her dress, her arm, was soaked in red and black. Livy raised her hand and wonderingly touched the hilt protruding from her chest. Her cheeks flared red.
"Ty?" she whispered.
Ty, I...
Her knees went out from under her. She thudded hard to the ground on her back. The blade was like an ugly massive insect fastened to her chest. A metal mosquito sucking the blood that ran from her wound. Red mixed with black of the sword spilling across the floor. In the aisle of the council hall, Ty looked up, his face turning the color of ashes. Emma had no idea if he could see them through the teeming crowd, see his sister, see what had happened. But his hands flew to his chest, pressing over his heart. He pitched to his knees, soundlessly, just as Livy had, and crumpled to the ground. Julian made a noise. It was a noise Emma couldn't have described, not as human a sound as a howl or a scream. It sounded like it was ripped out of the inside of him, like something brutal was tearing through his chest. He dropped the longsword Livy had risked so much to bring him, fell to his knees, and crawled to her, pulling her into his lap.
"Livy, Livy, my Livy,"
he whispered, cradling her, feverishly stroking her blood-wet hair away from her face. There was so much blood. He was covered in it in seconds. It had soaked through Livy's clothes. Even her shoes were drenched in it.
"Livia."
His hands shook. He fumbled at his steely, put it to her arm. The healing rune vanished as quickly as he drew it. Emma felt as if someone had punched her in the stomach. There were wounds that were beyond an Irazi's power. Healing runes only vanished from skin when occult poison was involved or when the person was already dead.
"Livia!"
Julian's voice rose, cracking and tumbling over itself like a wave breaking far out at sea.
"Livy, my baby, please, sweetheart, open your eyes. It's Jules. I'm here for you. I'm always here for you. Please, please."
Blackness exploded behind Emma's eyes. The pain in her arm was gone. She felt nothing at all but rage. Rage that bleached everything else out of the world except the sight of Annabelle cringing against the lectern, staring at Julian cradling his sister's dead body at what she'd done. Emma whirled and stalked toward Annabelle. There was nowhere she could go. The guards had circled the dais. The rest of the room was a seething mass of confusion. Emma hoped Ty was unconscious. She hoped he was seeing none of this. He would wake up eventually, and the horror of what he would wake up to drove her forward. Annabelle staggered back. Her foot slipped, and she tumbled to the floor. She raised her hand as Emma loomed up over her. Her face was a mask of fear. Emma heard Arthur's voice in her head. "Mercy is better than revenge." But it was fainter than Julian's whispers or Drew's sobs. She brought Cortana down, scything the blade through the air. But as it sliced the air, inky smoke erupted from the window behind Annabelle. It had the force of an explosion, a concussive wave knocking Emma backward. As she stumbled to her knees, she caught sight of a moving shape inside the smoke, the gleam of gold, the flash of a symbol burned into her brain, a crown broken in half. The smoke vanished, and Annabelle vanished with it. Emma curled her body over Cortana, clutching the blade to herself, her soul corroded with despair. All around her, she could hear the rising voices in the room, cries and shrieks. She could see Mark bent over Ty, who was crumpled on the floor. Mark's shoulders were shaking. Helen was struggling through the crowd toward both of them. Drew was on the ground, sobbing into her hands. Alec had slumped back against the doors of the hall, staring at the devastation. And there, in front of her, was Julian, his eyes and ears closed to anything but Livy, her body cradled against his. She seemed a drift of fragile ash or snow, something impermanent that had blown into his arms accidentally, the petal of a fairy flower, the white feather of an angel's wing, the dream of a little girl, the memory of a sister reaching up her arms. "Julian? Julian, carry me." But the soul, the spirit that made her Livy,
was no longer there. It was something that had gone away to a far and untouchable place. Even as Julian ran his hands over her hair again and again and begged her to wake up and look at him just one more time. High above the council hall, the golden clock began to chime the hour.
Lord of Shadows, The Dark Artifices, Book 2, was written by Cassandra Clare and read by James Marsters. It was recorded by Brianna Villarreal at North Hollywood Sound in California. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Lord of Shadows was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
This audiobook has been brought to you by Open Digital Library. To join us, just tap search. We are a community on VK. Open Digital Library. We post what others can't find.